ground of our own. All there is now is to get out. We charge through errant gunfire, coming from all directions. Most we can deflect easily enough. Some I throw back with force, but no aim. I curse through gritted teeth, blaming Cal, blaming Davidson, Farley, my father, even myself. Our plan accounted for nymphs, but not someone as powerful as Iris. I can't think of anyone else besides a few nymph lords who could be strong enough to loose the ocean on the fort, and none of them would destroy Patriot so willingly. But Iris, a princess of another nation, a woman with no loyalty to Norda, she could rip this place apart and feel nothing. Still call it victory. The seawall crashes behind us, echoing loudly even at a distance, followed by the roar of pummeling waves as they break and swell, rushing through the streets, foaming around the buildings and walls of Fort Patriot. I imagine it in my head, a wall like blue fire, consuming everything in its path. We sprint on, catching up to our battalion. Ptolemus barks at them to run, and they obey. Even the Montfort newbloods. There isn't time for posturing. The interior gates of Fort Patriot don't open onto the city, but onto a long bridge crossing the harbor, connecting the artificial island of the fort to the mainland. Meaning, we'll have to run the half mile on a bridge over water. With enemy nymphs behind us, not to mention a rising ocean. Not exactly a winning combination if your goal is don't drown. Our oblivions make quick work of the first set of gates, blowing the massive doors out onto the bridge. Iron reinforcements go flying, splashing violently into the water. I barely hear it over the approaching roar of the flood. Iris must still be standing over it all, triumphant, smiling as she watches us scramble like rats caught in a rainstorm. We hurry through the gate as the first swell hits, bringing with it a swirl of debris. Splintered wood, floating transports, guns, corpses. I run as fast as my legs will allow, wishing I were strong enough to lift us out of harm's way. But neither of us has ever mastered the art of magnetron flight. Only Father can truly do that for any real amount of time. The gravitrons guard our backs, using their abilities to push against the wave. They buy us time, but this swell is small, barely higher than the arch of the gate. Then the second wave, the true wave, hits, cresting over the walls themselves, smashing through the stone and concrete protecting the fort. The gravitrons are no use against such force, and can only save themselves, flying up and over. At least one gets caught in the spray, tangled up in a swirl of water. He never resurfaces. I don't spare him another thought. I can't. The bridge is meant to be a defense for the fort, a long choke point to prevent any army from storming Patriot by land. It funnels us through a series of locks and gates, each slowing us down. The oblivions do what they can, leading us through a rhythm of explosions as we tear through one obstacle after another. Ptolemus and I split apart hinges and reinforcements, ripping steel and iron in our desperation. We pass the halfway point, the city of Harbor Bay rising before our eyes, so close and yet so infinitely far. In a glance, I realize that the still, calm waters on either side of us are rising too, bulging, surging, growing like the crashing wave still hunting after us with the inexorable force of a hurricane. Salty spray blasts across my vision, drenching my face, stinging my eyes. I reach blindly, clinging to the collar of Tali's armor. With a roar of frustration, I launch us both, using my ability to drag us up and over the next gate. Our battalion be damned. They'll follow if they can, and if they can't, they were bound to be left behind anyway. How much does this armor weigh? A useless voice wonders in my head. Will I sink before I can shed it, end up at the bottom of the bay? Or worse, will I have to watch Ptolemus go into the waves and never come back up? Water laps at my ankles, My boots slide over the paved bridge, and I almost lose my footing. Only Ptolemus keeps me from plunging into the cloying depths. His arm now wrapped around my waist, holding me close. If we drown, we drown together. I can almost feel Iris's hunger as her waves pursue. She would love nothing more than to kill us. Kneecap the rift, one more enemy to her people. Kill us the way our army killed her father. I refuse to die like this. But I see no plan, no attack I can make alone. The nymphs controlling the waves will kill us without even showing their faces, unless we can somehow kill them first. I need a gravitron. I need a new blood. I need Mare and her storms to light these bastards up. Behind us, the thunder rumbles again, following the flash of random lightning. It isn't enough. All we can do is run and hope that someone else will save us. Such helplessness makes me sick. Another wave crashes, from our right this time. Smaller than the tidal force at our backs, but still strong. It breaks Tali's grip on me, splitting us apart. My hands grasp at thin air, and then stinging water as I fall headfirst, plunging into the port. Some fire blooms on the surface. Explosions. From oblivions or artillery fire, I can't tell. All I can do is run my hands over myself, shedding armor before it drags me deeper. I tried to keep my mental grip on Ptolemus's copper as it moves, struggling through the water with me. He's drowning too. I kick furiously, trying to surface. As I do, another wave hits me head-on, sending me spiraling into the deep again without a single gasp of air. The salt water stings my eyes and my lungs burn, but I try to swim, try to outrun the nymphs on the surface. The longer I stay down, the more dead I seem, the farther away I can get. It's Tali's turn to find me. A fist closes on the scruff of my undershirt, dragging me along. Through the murky water, I see his silhouette alongside mine, his other hand clenching something metallic. Steel, shaped like a large bullet. Smooth. It drags us along, pushed by Tali's own ability, like a motor. Clenching my teeth, I grab hold. My lungs scream for relief until I can't stand it any longer, letting loose a stream of bubbles. I gasp reflexively, choking down water. With a mighty kick and another burst of strength, Tali angles us to the surface even as my vision spots and darkens. He throws me forward, onto wet and shady sand. On hands and knees, I sputter and choke, trying to spit up the water as quietly as possible. He thumps a fist on my back. I can barely think, but I glance around anyway, eager to get my bearings. Even a second off guard could get us killed. We're under one of the docks of the aquarium port, in about 6 inches of lapping water. Boats hide us on either side, hemming us in with nothing but rotting seaweed, discarded rope, and barnacles. Ptolemus looks beyond the dock into the few feet of space, allowing us a prime view of the bridge and Fort Patriot beyond. The harbor is a surging cauldron, battered by dueling tides as the ocean itself rises and falls. Some wake crashes toward the shore, rapidly pushing water up to our necks. I sputter, grabbing at the rotted wood above my head, and for a moment I think we might find ourselves drowned on shore. But the water recedes, pulling back out again with unnatural force. We move with it, clambering to the supports holding up the end of the dock. I only have my knives and bullets now, my armor discarded somewhere at the bottom of the port. Not that I care. I can find metal anywhere I want on land. Ahead of us, waves assault the bridge again and again, tossing soldiers. Our battalion is a ruin, if not completely destroyed. House Samos will pay in blood today. The assault from the sea has failed. A jet screams through the clouds, circling the thunderheads dissipating over the fort. Two more give chase, their wings tipped in Laris yellow. As I watch, the hunted plane bursts into flame, shearing apart before crashing into the distant waves. A strong wind tears across the harbor as other Lares jets dot the sky, flying low over the city. The sound of them threatens to rip my head open, but I would cheer them on if I could. The fleet is our real advantage, especially with Patriot half underwater. Most of the fort is flooded, including the jetways. Only the Navy ships survived intact, still operational. They turn their guns on the Lares jets as they pass, spitting hot iron. One of the jets falls, a wing obliterated, before two more follow. "We have to disable the battleships," I mutter flatly, already exhausted by the prospect. Tali looks at me like I'm crazy. I very well may be. We sprint the edge of the harbor as fast as we can, moving in and out of a full-blown battle. Cal's land assault was the biggest of the three planned, utilizing hundreds of soldiers from our entire coalition, not to mention agents of the Scarlet Guard and their contacts already in the city. Trained soldiers grapple alongside thieves and criminals as guerrilla warfare overwhelms Harbor Bay from every gutter and alley. A city of white stone and blue roofs turns black and red, smoke and fire. Kalor colors, I think bitterly. But for which brother? The Norton Silvers and Conscripted Reds find themselves bogged down in the streets, restricted by their own regimented training. Bottlenecked, their numbers neutralized, but still dangerous. Tali and I risk our lives as we run, reforming our armor from whatever we can salvage, rusty bits and all. If I had the time, I would feel disgusted with my own poor work. Out on the water, maybe a mile out to sea, the Lares jets meet Norton and Piedmont jets. Cal's orders again. Keep the worst of their weapons and our own from the city. Even from this distance, I can hear the roar as they dance through the air at blinding speed. Bursts of fire and smoke spread across the aerial battle, sandwiched between the clouds and the horizon. I don't envy the pilots, especially the ones who must contend with Lares, Windweavers. It's difficult enough flying a jet without fighting the wind itself. Iris must still be near the warport, protecting the battleships from rough waves. As we approach, I can see that the water around the four massive steel hulls is still and smooth. The rest of the port boils and tosses, throwing back any attempts to take the ships from the mainland. Soon the Lakelander Princess will turn the big guns on the jets out at sea, or the city itself. Destroy Harbor Bay the way she broke the fort. Leave nothing but a ruin. Useless to either Kalor brother. Bright red slashes across my vision, jumping out onto the road from an alley. I never thought I'd be so relieved to find an armed squadron of Scarlet Guard, especially one led by General Farley. Her band of criminals rounds on us, guns raised. Reluctant but quick, I raise my hands, meeting her eyes. "Just us," I pant, gesturing for Ptolemus to do the same. She looks between us, eyes ticking like a pendulum, a scale settling on balance. My relief melts in an instant as I realize exactly what she could be weighing. My brother's life. She could try to kill him, kill us, right here, and no one would know. We could just be casualties of the battle, and she would have her revenge. It's what I would do if someone took Tali from me. The blonde woman's hand strays, finding the gun at her hip, fastened to a half-empty ammunition belt. She's been busy. I hold her shivering blue gaze, saying nothing, barely daring to breathe, trying not to tip her in the wrong direction. I set my teeth on edge, reaching out with every piece of my exhausted ability I can muster. Grabbing for her gun, her remaining bullets, the knives hidden all over her body, to stop her if she decides to strike. "Cal's this way," she finally says, snapping the string of tension between us. We need to get those ships out of their hands. Of course, Ptolemus replies, and I almost punch him in the teeth. Be quiet, I want to hiss. Instead, I step in front of him slightly, shielding his body from her wrath. Farley only twitches, staring at him for another blistering second. Fall in, soldiers, she sneers, before turning her back on us. Soldiers, not your highness, not our titles. If that's the worst she's going to do, I'll take it gladly. We do as commanded, sliding into formation with the rest of her band. I don't recognize any of them, and her guard are distinguished only by red sashes tied around arms or waists or wrists. The guard look ragtag, hastily thrown together, their clothes common. They could be servants or laborers, dock workers, low traders, cooks, drivers, but they share her steely disposition and determination, and they're armed to the teeth. I wonder how many Silvers kept such wolves in their own houses. I wonder how many there still are in mine. Our coalition holds a stretch of the port road as it curves around the harbor, looking out on the battleships blocking up the warport. Behind us are more barracks and military outbuildings, all overtaken. Many of our soldiers take up defensive positions, poking out of windows and doorways, and others form up at the port side, waiting for orders. Have we won the city? Cal stalks among his lieutenants and guards, more disheveled than I've ever seen him, his hair slick with sweat, the rest of him striped with ash and blood. I can barely discern the armor beneath, shimmering a deep ruby red between the dirty patches. He paces at the edge of the water, harried and frustrated, and careful to keep out of reach of the surging waves. Kalor princes hold no love for water. It makes them uncomfortable. Right now, Cal looks like he might crawl out of his own skin. His grandmother watches as he paces, her silks and gowns discarded for a simple uniform with no insignia to mark her rank, not even her colors. She could be just an old woman who wandered into the wrong crowd, but anyone with eyes knows better. Annabelle Larilan is not to be underestimated. At her side, Julian Jacos keeps silent, his lips pursed together, eyes fixed on the battleships, waiting to be of some use. My brother and I shoulder through the fray, entering Cal's line of vision. His brow rises at the sight of us. He might be as relieved as I am, and just as surprised by the sensation.
Good to see you standing, he says, offering us both nods. What about your battalion?
I put my hands on my hips. I don't know. Iris tossed us both into the port while our team was crossing the bridge. We had to swim out or drown. He watches me as I speak, intent and sharp, almost accusatory, as if I should feel shame for staying alive when others couldn't. I push past it. Did any make it to the city?
Hard to say. I sent out the word as best I could to regroup here. We'll see who gets the message and who can get back.
He frowns at his hands, then back at the battleships. Out on the water, they steer clear of their docks, idling instead of heading out to sea, setting their sights on us.
You are the only magnetrons we have right now.
No Samos cousins left, none but us. Next to me, Ptolemus scowls.
We'll do what we can with the missiles.
Cal looks back to my brother, his dark hair flicking with emotion.
I'm not wasting either of you catching missiles. We have enough Montfort bombers to destroy what can be destroyed.
He points with a single finger, gesturing to the harbor.
I want you on those ships.
I know we have to stop the battleships, but getting on them? I pale so quickly I can feel it, an icy cold spreading across my cheeks despite the heat of flame and ash and my own sweat. I don't fancy killing myself this late in the day, Kalor, I snap. With a sneer, I angle my chin toward the battleships, safe on the water. Iris will sink us like stones before we even get close. Even gravitrons— Cal just hisses to himself, frustrated.
When we win the city, remind me to give every Silver officer a crash course in new blood abilities. Arezzo, he adds, barking out the strange word over his shoulder. A woman shoulders forward in reply, her uniform the dark green of Montfort, covered in foreign insignia.
Sir, she says, ducking her chin.
Get your teleporters ready,
Cal commands. He seems almost amused, watching as I seethe, angry with him, and with myself for forgetting exactly what kind of army we're working with. Is there no end to these new blood peculiars?
Prepare to jump to those ships.
Yes, sir,
she says brusquely. With a wave, she draws forward other Montfort soldiers, other teleporters, I assume. I glance at my brother sidelong to gauge his reaction. Tali seems more preoccupied with the Red General. He keeps his eyes on her, never wavering, as if she might kill him if he drops his guard. It isn't entirely an irrational fear. And when we're on board? I step forward, putting myself toe to toe with my wretched betrothed. You'll need more than 2 magnetrons to take apart a battleship, and more than a few minutes. We're good, but we're not that good. Jerking, Cal steps back from a particularly exuberant wave, keeping his toes dry. He blinks rapidly, swallowing.
You don't need to take it apart. I want those ships. I need those ships, especially because Iris is here.
He licks his lips, a brush of terror flashing in his eyes.
Her mother won't leave her out to dry.
Ugh, does he try to make such awful puns?
If the Lakelander fleet gets here before we have real artillery protecting the harbor, we're done for,
Cal adds, looking over my head to the water. I raise a hand, pointing out past the flooded fort to the ocean hazed by smoke and the still dancing forms of air jets.
You think 4 ships can hold back a Lakelander armada?
They'll have to.
Well, they won't. You know that.
Only a muscle in his cheek twitches, jumping as he tightens his jaw. You're going to have to get your hands dirty, Kalor, dirtier than they already are. I move again, planting myself in his eyeline.
You said yourself, the Queen of the Lakelands won't abandon her daughter, so we trade her.
Cal pales like I did, all color draining from his face in shock.
For the city, I push on. He must understand. Ptolemus and I can lock the guns in position, make them fire on her, pin her down, keep her cornered. Shouldn't be difficult for a Fire King to subdue her, should it?
Again, nothing. Cal doesn't even blink, his face stubborn in its stillness.
Coward, I sneer in my head. He doesn't want to face her. The Flame of the North is afraid of a bit of rain. When we have Iris, we bargain. Her life for the bay.
That snaps his restraint in half.
I don't do that,
he barks, his voice rough, all edges. In spite of myself, I take a step back, almost cowed by his sudden fury.
I'm not him, Evangeline.
At that, I have to scoff.
Well, he's winning.
I'm not doing it,
he says again, the words shaking with anger. Princes aren't used to repeating themselves.
I'm not taking hostages.
I'm not giving Maven a reason, you mean, I think to myself, a bitter echo in my head. A reason to take her back, to bend all his resources on one particular person. He has the unthinkable gall to put a finger in my face.
Get the ships, get the guns, and get Iris out of the bay. That's an order.
I'm not your soldier, and I'm not your wife yet, Kalor. You don't get to order me around,
I snarl, feeling as if I could take a bite out of him.
Her mother will drown this city and us if you let her.
He stares at me, furious, his hand trembling, so angry he doesn't notice when a wave hits his ankles. When he jumps, cursing, I want to laugh in his ridiculous face.
Her mother will let this city be if her daughter is able to escape.
A voice pipes up behind him. Granny to the rescue, Kalor. The prince frowns, forehead wrinkling in confusion.
She's right,
his uncle says, his voice far softer than Annabelle's. Cal's eyebrows almost disappear into his hairline.
Julian?
He asks, almost inaudible.
Jacobs just shrugs, crossing his hands over his thin chest.
I have little talent on the battlefield, but that doesn't make me talentless. It's a good plan, Cal. Drive Iris out to sea.
Then his eyes fall on me.
Get to a ship, Evangeline,
he says slowly, his voice empty of his ability. I realize the threat all the same. I have no choice in this, not with the loaded gun of a singer staring me down. I do this of my own volition, or I do it of his.
Fine.
For all his shortcomings, Cal certainly is noble to a fault. Usually it makes me hate him all the more. Except now. As he pledged before in Montfort, he won't let anyone fight for him unless he's fighting for himself. He won't make anyone do what he isn't willing to do with them. So when the teleporters gather, hands outstretched, he is next to me, armed and ready to storm a battleship.
The first time isn't pleasant,
my teleporter says to me, his face grim and lined with age, a veteran of many battles. I can only grip my teeth at him and take his hand. It feels like being squeezed down to my marrow, all my organs twisting, my balance thrown off, my perception turned on its head. I try to gasp and find I can't breathe, can't see, can't think, can't exist, until it disappears as fast as it came. I gulp down air, knees to the steel-plated deck of a battleship, while the teleporter stands over me. He reaches to cover my mouth, but I swat him away, shooting him a murderous glare at the same time. We're behind the forward gun turret, crouched alongside cold steel and smooth cylindrical gun barrels. They're red hot and still smoking from their barrage on the fort, and now trained on the city. My ability rushes their length, feeling out the rivets and bolts, jumping from one barrel to another, into the powder magazine, almost full, and the artillery shells waiting, more than a dozen ready. I assume the same for the two other turrets fore and aft, dotting the length of the ship. There's enough ammunition to turn Harbor Bay to ash, I mutter, if only to myself. The teleporter responds only with a fuming glare. He reminds me of my father, flint-eyed, focused. I do as I must. With a grimace, I put my hands to the turret and pull. It strains against me, already locked and aimed elsewhere. But once I get the gears moving in their track, it goes easily, shifting at my touch, turning, facing another target. Iris's own battleship. She paces the deck of the boat farthest out to sea, a silhouette in dark blue. Her own Lakelanders flank her, their uniforms easy to pick out. Farther down the ship, at the prow, a figure in red blinks into existence, a teleporter and his own soldiers at his back.
Almost,
I hiss, sliding the turret into place, its barrels now aimed at Iris's broadside. With a clenching fist, I fuse the steel and iron plate together, locking the turret into position. No one but a magnetron, or someone with a blowtorch, could aim this gun now.
Next gun.
With another sickening jump, we land alongside the second turret. I do the same again, shifting the guns. This time, a pair of red conscripts find us. They rush at me, but the teleporter grabs them both and disappears. He flashes at the corner of my eye, out over the water. Both reds plummet into the bay. The teleporter returns before I hear their splashes. The third turret fights worse than the others, straining against my ability, refusing to move as smoothly as the others.
They figured us out,
I growl, breaking a sweat. The gunner is trying to keep the turret in place.
Are you a magnetron or not?
The teleporter sneers at me. I hope Ptolemy's got someone less mouthy, I think, wincing. With a burst of force, I get the turret turning, and I crush it into position with more fervor than necessary. The base crumples inward, stuck on its track.
It's done. Give the signal.
It's easier to trip the gun mechanism than I thought it would be. like pulling a gigantic trigger. The resulting boom of a single artillery shell sends me sideways, clutching my ears. Everything rings and dulls in succession. I fight to my feet, watching as the round hits home, exploding on the deck of Iris's battleship. Fire races its length, a vicious snake coiling with hissing fury. Larger than a blow from a single shell, a few soldiers jump into the bay to escape its wrath. Cal's wrath. The Lakelanders are less deterred, drawing an arcing wave up and over the ship, letting it crash and consume, dousing the fire. Only for another shell to hit them dead on, this time from Ptolemus's ship on their opposite side. I can't help but grin, almost cheering him on. Again, Cal runs flame across the battleship. More flee, more jump. Another wave, another shell, another flame. The rhythm pulls back and forth. My teleporter jumps us between the turrets, and each time we find more soldiers to fight off. Reds, mostly. Silvers don't work ships in great numbers, only as officers. They are easy to deflect between my ability and the Montfortons. If I could, I would have him jump me to Cal. He doesn't have the stomach to kill Iris, but I certainly do. The Lakelands are already furious with us after their king's death. It won't matter if she dies, too. In fact, it might send them scurrying back to their lakes and farms to rethink standing against the might of Samos and Kalor. But my job is to man the guns, hold the ship. With Cal battling Iris, her attention is off the bay, and our soldiers begin the crossing. During our third pass down the ship, more teleporters jump onto the deck, bringing with them six soldiers each. And more soldiers arrive in the boats below, fast on the approach. I squint at the far battleship, watching as I land another round. This one hits hard, punching a smoking hole in the hull a few yards above the waterline. On deck, the sight is terrifying. The clouds darken overhead, thick with lightning. Fire and water collide over the battleship, inferno and tidal wave. The ship tips with the force of such a battle, one royal silver against another. Warriors equally matched and unevenly set. For the first time in my life, I truly wonder what will happen if Tiberius Kalor dies. I think Iris is going to kill him.
20. Mare. The miles are few, but they feel endless. I keep my grip on the door handle, ready to spring out the second we roll onto the port road, wheels spinning beneath us. It's just me, the Electricons, and our driver. Even Ella is silent, staring out the window at the darkening sky. The smoke of Newtown gives way to black, acrid clouds the closer we get to Harbor Bay. At first, I'm grateful that I don't have to speak to anyone, but as the minutes wear on, the silence grows thicker, heavier, pressing down on me. It makes it difficult to think of anything beyond the city ahead and the battle raging there. In the distance, the horizon seems to burn. My mind spins out, filling in the blanks of what we might find. Each scenario is worse than the last. Surrender, defeat, Farley dying, Tiberius pale and bleeding, his blood a silver halo. The last time I was in Harbor Bay, I traveled through tunnels and alleyways. I didn't tear through the streets in a military transport, escorted like some kind of dignitary or noble. I barely recognized the place. I expect opposition as we roll into the city, but the battle lines are farther in than I thought. The streets are largely empty of everything but soldiers. All hours, marching to their posts or working their patrols. Once or twice, I spot a contingent of coalition soldiers flanking prisoners, silvers handcuffed in iron, being led away to wherever we might be keeping them. Davidson's orders, I assume. He knows how to leverage prisoners best. The transport angles beneath me, beginning the gentle descent to the harbor.
The coalition is forming up on the waterfront, fortifying our position before they try to push back into the fort.
Our driver calls back to us. A radio in his console blares, mostly static, but a few jumbled words get through. He relays what he can. Sounds like the air fleet is holding the Norton jets out at sea, and we're doing what we can to win the warships in the harbor, but there's Lakelander ships on the horizon. Across from me, Rafe curses under his breath, well out of range. He mutters. Let me be the judge of that, Ella replies sternly, still at the window. Titan leans back in his seat, his lips pursed. So we hold the city, for now. Seems like it, I reply, still wary as ever. The transport rolls on, passing larger buildings and more important-looking places. My body is tight as a coiled wire, ready to react if this calm is just a trap, a feint to lure Tiberius and the others into a false sense of security. I keep my teeth gritted together and the feel of lightning close. My fellow electricons do the same, each of them stern and ready to fight. The churning waters of the harbor flash at the end of the street, beyond a scurrying crowd of soldiers. It looks like a storm has just passed through. Every surface is wet, and dark gray clouds are breaking up overhead, blown off by a furious gale. Waves lap at the curved shoreline, still foaming white like the surface of a boiling pot. I can see now that out in the harbor, Fort Patriot is a ruin, one half flooded, the other half burning. I can smell it, even across the water. The bridge to the fort is just as obliterated, parts of it overtaken by the sea. My forehead touches the glass of the window as I strain to see more. Our soldiers busy themselves clearing debris, building makeshift walls, or setting machine guns. I search their ranks, looking for familiar faces as we drive onto the paved plaza lining the waterfront. They all look the same, even in their differing uniforms. Dirty-faced, bleeding both colors, exhausted and ready to drop, but alive. Their ranks part for the transport as we round the water, heading toward the center of the waterfront and the now smashed gates of the fort bridge. Ella and I bunch up at the right-hand window, craning for a better view. Across from us, Rafe does the same. Only Titan remains still, glaring at his dirty boots. The ships are firing on each other, Ella breathes, pointing out the battleships still in the harbor. Look, 3-1. I bite my lip, confused for only a moment. In the distance, the gray hulks bob in the water, rocking with the force of their own heavy guns. Indeed, three of them seem to be shooting at the fourth. I wonder which side has the upper hand. Our coalition or Maven's? Smaller boats venture into the choppy waters, carrying soldiers toward the battleships. The transport barely halts before my boots hit the wet pavement. Each step slick and precarious. I keep my balance, shoving through the crowd of soldiers. The other electricons follow. We make for the knot of officers near the waterline, watching over the boats moving across the harbor. In the distance, the fourth battleship rides the waves, tipping back and forth beneath the force of bombardment. I barely glance at it, hunting for familiar faces among the soldiers. I see Farley first, her golden hair gleaming against the gray of battle. Binoculars dangle around her neck, forgotten for a moment. She barks orders in steady rhythm, gesturing between her officers. She doesn't seem to notice the men stacking up crates, building a meager wall to protect their general. Some of the tension in my chest releases, and I breathe a bit easier. Julian is here as well, to my relief. He and Queen Annabelle hang close, both of them transfixed by the battleships in the harbor. Their stare is unwavering, and Annabelle clutches Julian's arm, her knuckles white against his sleeve. The sight unsettles me, but I can't say why. Where do you need us? I clip, entering their circle as calmly as I can. Farley rounds on me, sputtering, and I brace for the inevitable rebuke. What are you doing here? She snaps. Is something wrong in Newtown? Newtown is won, Ella offers, crossing her arms at my side. Rafe nods. Put us to work here, General. It's Iris Signet out there, Farley snarls, gesturing to the ships. Then she hesitates, teeth on edge. It makes me uneasy. I put a hand to her arm. Maven's queen is formidable, but not unbeatable. Iris doesn't scare me. Farley, let us help. Out in the harbor, a burst of red flame runs the length of the fourth ship, moving strangely. A massive, unnatural wave rises up to meet it, breaking across the deck. Another curl of fire erupts, spiraling in the air as more tongues of water twist and spray. They move together, an elemental dance that could only be the work of two very specific people. My heart drops in my chest, frozen with fear and fury. The sky turns black above the harbor, clouds reforming in an instant, purple flashes deep within, matching the rhythm of my beating heart. "What is he doing?" I snarl to no one, taking a step toward the water. Something snaps apart inside me. Any objective I might have had, all thoughts of the city, disappear in an instant. "Easy, Mare," I hear Ella say, trying to catch my arm, but I shove her off. I have to get to that ship. I have to stop him. "You don't have the aim to help him from here," she shouts, her voice fading. I'm faster in a crowd, more agile. They can't keep up. I work my way to the water's edge. Desperation might swallow me whole. Cal is fighting a nymph, a powerful nymph. His greatest weakness? It terrifies me. Boats shuttle back and forth across the harbor, the empty ones returning to load more soldiers. I watch with my teeth gritted so tightly they might shatter. Too slow. "Teleporters!" I shout, desperate and in vain. The sound of the guns all but drowns me out. "Teleporters!" I scream again. No one comes running. The boats might be slow-moving, but they're my best chance. I have a foot in one when Farley catches up to me, seizing me by the shoulders. She all but drags me backward, my boots splashing through the shallow water of the docks. I shrug her off, twisting with motions I learned a long time ago, in the alleys of the stilts. She stumbles but catches herself, hands outstretched. Her face flushes scarlet. "Get me on that ship, Farley!" My voice shakes with anger. I feel like I might explode. "I'm not asking for your permission." "Okay," she concedes, her eyes wide with a fear of her own. "Okay." A flash out on the water stills us both, and Farley's words die on her lips. We watch in stunned silence as a succession of explosive rounds pummel into Iris's ship, rocking the craft. Waves rise up to stabilize it, even as the explosions spread, red and angry, each an inferno reaching skyward. Smoke billows, black and reeking, as another wave pulls over the ship. Soldiers fall from the deck, splashing into the harbor below. From this distance, I can't distinguish their uniforms. Red, green, or blue? I can't tell. But his armor flashes brightly against the fire, impossible to miss. Without thinking, I rip the binoculars off Farley's neck and press them to my eyes. I feel frozen by what I see, rooted, unable to move. Iris dodges a fireball, dipping with liquid motion, faster than Tiberius ever was. She dances out of his reach, circling even as the ship beneath them moves, churning its way toward the mouth of the harbor and the open ocean. The valiant, stupid Kalor pursues. Another wave hits him head-on, crashing blue and white with the full force of Iris Signet's power. My heart stops in my chest as I imagine him crushed against the metal ship, drowning before my eyes. He falls, his armor broken, splintered by battle, his scarlet cape torn to pieces. For such a large man, Tiberius makes such a tiny splash. My vision spots, hazy with every emotion, as my own brain overloads. Everything narrows, edged with black, until I can't hear the crowd around me. Even Farley's voice fades, her barking orders disappearing. I want to scream, but find my teeth welded together. If I move, if I speak, all my restraint will disappear too. The lightning will have no mercy. All I can do is stare, stand, and pray to whoever might be listening. Warm hands hold my shoulders as the electricons surround me, close enough to react if I lose control. Blue, green, white. Ella, Rafe, Titan. Cal. 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 Survive. Nothing matters but the water, blue and white waves foaming with battle. Most of the soldiers who fell from the ships are still alive, bobbing up and down. But they aren't wearing armor. They aren't terrified of water. They didn't face Iris, Signet, and Luz. The glare from the sun makes it impossible to see much, but I squint anyway, until I can't stand it anymore, until I can't open my eyes. The binoculars drop from my hands and smash. The chaos on the water's edge grows, until every soldier stands in wait, breathless to see the fate of the Kalor Prince. When they gasp as one, I force my eyes open and turn. Titan's grip on me turns vice-like, his fingers pressed against my neck. He'll knock me out if he has to protect everyone else from my sorrow. I don't know who dragged Tiberius out of the water or which teleporter brought him to the shore. I don't watch the healer as she bends, terrified, trying to save his life. I don't care about Iris, still out in the harbor making her escape. I can only look at him, even though I never want to see him like this. Each passing second is a ruin. I've been shot, I've been stabbed, I've been hollowed out. This is 1,000 times worse. Silver skin is a colder color than our own, as if drained of warmth. But I've never seen a silver look like he does. His lips are blue, his cheeks like glowing moonlight, every inch of him soaking or bleeding. His eyes are shut, he isn't breathing. Tiberius looks like a corpse. He could be a corpse. Time stretches. I live in this cursed second, trapped, doomed to watch little pieces of his life ebb away. Killorn survived in Newtown. Will I lose Tiberius in Harbor Bay? The healer puts her palms to his chest, sweat beating on her brow. I pray to any god who might exist, to anyone who might listen. Then I beg. Water sprays from his mouth as he coughs violently, his eyes flying open at the same time. I almost collapse, and only the electricons keep me standing against the sudden rush. Gasping, I put a hand to my mouth to stifle the sound, only to feel tears on both my cheeks. The crowd of people around him surges, Annabelle moving to kneel at his side. Julian is there, too. They croon over their boy, smoothing his hair, bidding him to lie still as the healer continues her work. He nods weakly, still getting his bearings. I turn away before he sees me and realizes how much I want to stay. Ocean Hill was a favorite of Corianne, the dead queen I never knew. It's a favorite of her son as well. The palace is polished white stone, with blue-domed roofs crowned in silver flames. Still magnificent, even through the trailing smoke and falling ash. We circle the plaza in front of the palace gates, usually a mess of traffic. The only activity seems to be at the neighboring security center, now overrun with coalition soldiers. As we pass, they rip down the red, black, and silver banners, as well as the hung images of Maven Kalor. One by one, they set fire to the symbols. I watch his face burn, blue eyes locked on mine through a devouring tangle of red flame. The streets themselves are empty, and the fountain I remember, beautiful beneath a dome of crystal, is dry. War walks the stones of Harbor Bay. The palace gates are already open, yawning wide for Farley and me. We've been here before, as intruders, fugitives. Not today. When the transport slows, Farley is quick to clamber out, gesturing for me to follow. But I hesitate, still haunted by the events of the morning. It's only been a few hours since I watched Tiberius almost die. I can't get the sight out of my head. "Meh," she prods, her voice low. It's enough to snap me into action. The cerulean doors of the palace swing open on silent hinges, revealing two members of the Scarlet Guard keeping watch. Their ripped scarves are ruby bright, hopelessly out of place, and a sharp, unmistakable sign. We have returned here as conquerors. Ocean Hill still reeks of disuse and abandonment. I don't think Maven ever set foot inside once he became king. Corianne's faded golden colors hang from the walls and vaulted ceiling. It remains a tomb to a forgotten queen, empty but for her memory, and perhaps even her ghost. I see an odd reversal as I walk, noting the faces around me. A few reds of the Scarlet Guard keep watch, their weapons openly displayed, but most seem without purpose, recovering in the wake of battle, dozing against opulent columns, or lazily exploring the many salons and chambers branching off the central gallery. It's the Silvers who busy themselves with more menial work, probably on Annabelle's orders. They have to prepare Tiberius's new seat, his palace, to mark him as a legitimate ruler and king. They open windows, pull the covers from furniture, even dust off sills and statues. I blink at the sight, overwhelmed. Silver's doing housework. What a concept. The Red servants must have fled, and the Red still here certainly won't do it for them. I don't recognize anyone in passing. No Julian, not even Annabelle supervising as her sworn soldiers prepare the palace. It worries me because there's only one other place they could be, and clearly they have to be there. I'm almost sprinting when Evangeline catches me, springing out from around a corner. Her armor is gone, discarded for lighter underclothes. If the battle was difficult for her, she certainly doesn't look it. While everyone else is dirty, if not still bloody, Evangeline Samos looks fresh from a cold bath. Get out of my way, is all I can manage, trying to step around her. Farley halts, looking on with a glare. Let her go, Samos, she snarls. Evangeline ignores her. Instead, she seizes my shoulders, forcing me to look her in the eye. I resist the familiar urge to deck her and instead let her look. To my surprise, she searches me over, eyes lingering on my many cuts and bruises. You should see a healer first. We have plenty, she says. You look horrible. Evangeline, she sharpens. He's fine. I promise you that. My eyes snap to hers. I know that, I hiss. I saw him with my own eyes. Even so, I clench my teeth at the memory, too fresh and still too painful. He's alive. He survived her. The nymph princess, I remind myself. His brother's deadly queen. I could wring his neck for doing it, challenging a nymph in the middle of the bay. I've seen Tiberius Calor balk at swimming across a stream. He hates water, fears it like nothing else. It's the worst and easiest way for him to die. Evangeline bites her lip, watching me. She likes something in what she sees. When she speaks again, her voice is changed, softened, a feather-light whisper. I can't forget it. How he sank like a stone, armor and all, she says, moving close enough to speak in my ear. The words twist around me, prickling on my skin. How long was it until the healers got him breathing again? I squeeze my eyes shut, trying not to remember. I know what you're doing, Evangeline, and it's working. Tiberius, pale and dead, his body soaked through, mouth parted, eyes open and empty, unseeing. Shade's body was the same, and it haunts me still. When I open my eyes again, Tiberius's corpse is still there, hovering in my mind. I can't shake the sight. That's enough, Farley says, stepping bodily between us. She all but hauls me away, with Evangeline smirking. She falls into step behind us, prodding me in the right direction, like I'm a cow being led to pasture, or slaughter. I don't know Ocean Hill, but I know palaces well enough to know what I'm looking for. We climb a garish, winding stairwell to the residences, a floor dotted with royal chambers and apartments. Up here, away from the more public levels, the dust is worse than ever. It puffs up from the carpet in clouds. Corianne's colors are all over, gold and yellow, pale and worn, forgotten everywhere but here. I wonder if they bring her son pain, her son who almost joined her in death. The king's chambers are vast, opening off a guarded entry lined with Lareland soldiers. They share Annabelle's colors and her coloring. Black hair and bronze eyes. Tiberius's eyes. No one stops us as we pass, stepping into the sunken room now serving as a receiving chamber. A very crowded one, I see Julian first, his back to the arched windows, looking out on the now sparkling bay. It gleams blue in the afternoon sun. He angles his face to me, features pulling into an expression I can't name. Sarah Skonos stands at his side, her posture violently straight with her hands clasped in front of her. Though her hands are clean, the sleeves of her simple uniform are crusted to the elbows in both red and silver blood. I shudder at it. She doesn't notice me at first, focus on the mountainous man in the center of the room. He sinks to his knees. Farley quietly takes a seat, maneuvering herself in between a pair of Scarlet Guard lieutenants. She gestures for me to join her, but I stay put. I prefer the edges of this particular crowd. I've never officially met the ruling lord of House Rombos, but I recognize his bulk, even kneeling. His robes are unmistakable, resplendent in rich chocolate and crimson, edged with precious stones. He is their leader and the ruling governor of this city and region. His hair is dirty blonde, giving over to gray, braided back from his face in once intricate rows. They're coming undone, either from the battle or from the great lord pulling at his hair in desperation. I suppose both. Silvers are not accustomed to surrendering. I exhale and will myself to look up from Rombos's shoulders to the true king standing above him, sword in hand. The sight of him erases the corpse from my mind. His fingers hold firm, unwavering, his grip tight on the adorned hilt of the ceremonial blade. Where it came from, I don't know. It isn't the sword Alara made him kill his father with, but it looks close enough, and I'm sure he remembers it now, as he stands above another man begging for his life. It must pain him to do this to someone else, and of his own volition this time. Tiberius looks paler than usual, cheeks drained of color, but in shame or fear, I can't tell. Maybe it's exhaustion or pain. In spite of it, he is every inch a king. His armor cleaned, his crown donned. The angled lines of his jaw and cheekbones look sharper somehow, honed by the sudden weight on his shoulders. It's a mask, all of it. A brave face he must wear. His other hand is empty, fingers bare without flame. No fire but the one burning in his eyes.
"The city is yours,"
Rombos says, his head bowed and hands raised. Queen Annabel steps close to her grandson's shoulder, fingers curled like talons. She might be the only person on earth who can seem royal without her finery.
"You will address him properly, Lord Rombos."
He is quick to acquiesce, dipping further, almost kissing his lips to the carpeted floor.
"Your Majesty, King Tiberius,"
he offers without hesitation. He spreads his hands wide in open faith.
"The city of Harbor Bay and the entirety of the Beacon region is rightfully yours, returned to the true king of Norta."
Tiberius looks down his straight nose, turning the blade. The edge catches the light. The lord flinches, squinting against the sudden glare.
"And what of House Rombos?"
he asks. "Next to me," Evangeline snorts into her hand. "What a performance."
"We are yours as well. To do with as you wish,"
the lord murmurs, his voice broken. For all he knows, Tiberius could execute his entire family, pull them out at the root, wipe their name and their blood from the face of the earth. Silver kings have done worse for less.
"Our soldiers, our money, our resources are at your disposal,"
he adds, listing off all his house can give, all his living house can give. A bead of silence stretches, taut as a pulled wire, threatening to snap apart. Tiberius surveys Lord Rombos without blinking, without feeling, his face blank and unreadable. Then he bears a smile. It bleeds warmth and understanding. I can't tell if it's real.
"I thank you for it," he says.
inclining his head a fraction. Beneath him, Lord Rombo saw but shudders in relief.
Just as I will thank every member of your house when they follow your example and pledge an oath of loyalty to me, forsaking the false king who sits on my father's throne.
At his side, Annabelle beams. If she coached him, she did it well.
Yes. Yes, of course.
Rombo stammers. He all but falls over himself to agree. I notice Tiberius edging his toes away, lest the fallen lord try to kiss them.
That will be arranged as soon as possible. Our strength is yours.
Tiberius's face tightens.
By tomorrow, my lord.
Leaving no room for argument.
By tomorrow, your majesty.
Rhombos replies, bobbing his head. Still kneeling, he clenches both meaty fists.
All hail Tiberius the Seventh, King of Norta, and true flame of the North, he shouts,
his voice stronger by the second. The crowd of advisors and soldiers, both silver and red, responds in kind, repeating the obnoxious titles. A bit of color returns to Tiberius's cheeks as he flushes. His eyes dart back and forth, trying to note who cries his name and who doesn't. His eyes land on me and my unmoving lips. I hold his gaze, feeling a thrill as I keep my mouth resolutely shut. Farley does too, examining her nails instead of the unfolding pageantry. Annabelle basks in it, one hand on her grandson's shoulder. Her left hand, laid just so, to display an old wedding ring, set with a black gemstone. The only jewelry on her, and the only one she ever needs.
All hail,
she murmurs, her eyes shining as she looks up at Tiberius. At some flicker in his face, she springs into action, moving in front of him. She clasps her lethal hands together, rings still exposed.
The king thanks you for your loyalty, as do I. We have much to discuss in the coming hours.
It's as good as a dismissal. Tiberius turns, putting his back to the room, and I realize what an admission it is. He's tired. He's wounded. Maybe not in body, but somewhere deep, where no one can see. The rigid set of his shoulders, his familiar posture, slumps beneath the ruby-red pauldrons of his armor, releasing some weight, or giving into it. Somehow all thoughts of his corpse come rushing back. Dread pools in me, threatening to fill me up and drag me down. I step forward, meaning to stay, but the crowd works against me, as does Evangeline. She takes me under my arm, her decorative claws still donned and digging into soft flesh. I grip my teeth, letting her lead me out of his chambers, not wanting to cause a fuss or a scene. Julian passes by us with a single raised eyebrow, surprised to see us in such close confidence. I try to communicate with my eyes, try to ask for some help or guidance, but he turns away before he knows what I want. Or he simply doesn't want to give it. We pass the guards again, the Larrylands looking like sentinels in their colors of red and orange. Perhaps that's where the robes first came from. I look back, over the heads of silver lords and red officers. Farley's blonde hair glints somewhere, with Ptolemy's Samos keeping a safe distance from her. I see Annabelle, watching like a hawk. She plants herself in front of the door to Tiberius's bedchamber. He slips behind it, out of sight without so much as a backward glance.
Don't argue,
Evangeline hisses in my ear. On instinct, I open my mouth to do just that. But I cut myself off as she drags me sideways, out of the crowd and into the corridor. Even though we're as safe as possible for the circumstances, my heart beats a ragged rhythm in my chest.
You said yourself locking us in a closet together wouldn't work. I'm not locking anyone anywhere, she whispers back. I'm just showing you the door.
We turn and turn, taking the side stairs and servants' passages far too slowly and too quickly for my liking. My inner compass spins, and I think we're almost where we started when she halts within a dimly lit passage, almost too narrow for us to squeeze through. With a ripple of unease, I think of my earring, the one I'm not wearing. A blood-red stone, tucked away in a box in Montfort, hidden from the world. On my right, Evangeline lays her palm against an old door, rusted over from disuse. The hinges and lock have gone dark red, crusting like dried blood. With a flick of her fingers, the metal spins, shedding the rust like droplets of water. "This will take you. I know where it's going to take me," I reply, almost too fast. I suddenly feel like I've run a mile. Her grin sets me on edge and almost makes me turn around. Almost. "Very well," she says, taking a step back. Her hand brushes through the air, gesturing to the door like it's a priceless gift. Instead of the naked manipulation it is.
"Do what you want, Lightning Girl. Go where you please. No one will stop you."
I have no clever response for her. All I can do is watch her slink away, eager to be rid of me. Elaine must be on her way to the city to help celebrate this victory. I find myself envying them. They're on the same side, at least. Allied, despite the impossibilities stacked against them. Both silver, both raised noble. They know each other in a way Tiberius and I could never. They are the same. Equals. He and I are not. I should turn around. But I'm already through the door, pushing through the semi-darkness of a forgotten passage, my fingertips brushing along cool stone. A light bleeds ahead, closer than I thought it would be, outlining another door. Turn around. My hands flatten against the wood, a smooth cut, uniquely carved. I trace the panels for a moment, on edge. I know where this path leads, and who waits on the other side. Footsteps sound inside the room, making me jump as they pass. Then a chair creaks as a heavy weight sits. Two thumps announce his boots as he kicks them up on a desk or table. And then a long, lingering sigh. Not the satisfied kind. Full of frustration. Full of pain. Turn around. The knob moves in my hand as if of its own volition, and I step out, blinking into the soft light of afternoon. Tiberius's bedchamber here is large and airy, with vaulted ceilings painted blue and white, almost like clouds. The windows look out on the bay, and a sunnier day than it should be. The ocean breeze blows the last of the smoke away. It looks like the king is doing his best to fill the place with his usual mess, despite only having been here a few hours. He sits at a desk haphazardly dragged to the center of the room, angled away from a bed I refuse to even glance at. Papers and books pile around him. One in particular lies open, the text inside handwritten in a tight, looping scrawl. When I finally get the courage to look at him, Tiberius is already standing. He has a fist raised and flaming, his entire body coiled like a snake, ready to spring. His eyes rove over me, hand still ablaze, even though I'm not a threat. After a long moment, he brushes away the fire, letting it flicker and die. "You got here in a hurry," Tiberius blurts out, almost breathless. It takes us both off guard, and he looks away, easing back into his desk chair. He puts his back to me and quickly shuts the book with one hand. It spits dust. The cover is worn, a faded gold, with no writing on it and a broken binding. He shoves it away, tucking it into a drawer with little regard. Then he pretends to busy himself with some reports. He even bends over them with a very obvious squint. I smirk to myself and take a step toward him. Turn around. Another step into the room. The air seems to vibrate on my skin. After the... I stumble. There's no easy way to say it. After. I had to see for myself, I reply, watching the side of his mouth lift. His eyes don't move, burning a hole into the page in front of him. And? Shrugging, I rest my hands on my hips. You're fine. I shouldn't have bothered. At the desk, he barks out a harsh, but genuine laugh. Tiberius leans backward, putting an arm over his chair, twisting to look at me fully. In the daylight, his bronze eyes gleam like molten metal. They run over me, snagging on the exposed cuts and bruises. His gaze feels like fingers.
"What about you?"
he asks, his voice lower. I hesitate a little. My own injuries seem small compared to what he suffered, and to the memory of Killorn choking on his own blood. Nothing that can't be mended. He purses his lips.
"That's not what I asked."
"Nothing to compare, I mean," I tell him, circling to the front of his desk. He moves with me, tracking like a hunter. It feels similar to a dance or a pursuit. "Not all of us can say we almost died today."
"Oh, that."
He mutters and runs a hand through his hair. The short locks stand on end, mussing an otherwise kingly appearance.
"Everything went to plan."
I scowl, showing my teeth. Funny, I don't remember fighting a killer nymph in the middle of the ocean being part of the plan. He adjusts in his chair, uncomfortable. Slowly, he starts discarding his armor, revealing the thin, tight shirt and trimmer form beneath. It's a dare, but I hold my ground. Each piece hits the floor with a resounding clatter.
"We needed the ships. We needed the harbor."
I keep circling, and he keeps tossing pieces of armor away. He unfastens his gauntlets with his teeth, never taking his eyes off me.
"And we needed you to go toe-to-toe with her? Who had the advantage there, Tiberius?"
The king smirks against red steel.
"I'm still alive."
"That isn't funny." Something tightens in my chest. I run a finger down the adorned edge of his desk, swiping at the dusty surface. My skin comes away, gray, leached of warmth, like it was when I masqueraded as a silver, suffering through painted-on makeup just to keep breathing.
"We almost lost Killorn today."
Tiberius's smirk drops instantly, wiped away, and he forgets the armor for a moment. Darkness clouds his eyes, dulling their gleam.
"I thought Newtown fell easily. They didn't expect—"
He cuts himself off, clenching his teeth. I look away as his gaze lands on me. I don't want to see his pity.
"What happened?"
My breath feels ragged in my throat. It feels too close to relive. The danger still near. "Silver guards," I mumble.
"A Telki. Tossed him down a stairwell. Tore up his insides."
The words hitch as the memory reigns. My oldest friend, his skin going pale, dying faster by the second. Red blood on his chin, his chest, his clothes, all over my hands. The king doesn't say anything, holding his tongue. With a great burst of will, I look back at his face to find him staring, eyes wide, lips pressed into a grim, thin line. The concern is clearly written on him, in his furrowed brow and tight jaw. I force myself to move again, my path taking me back around. Closer to his chair, into the circle of familiar heat. "We got him to a healer in time," I say as I walk. "He'll be all right, same as you." When I pass behind him, I bite back the urge to touch his shoulders, to put one hand on either side of his neck and lean forward, bracing myself against him, letting him hold me up. Now more than ever, the need to let go and rest, to allow someone else to carry my burdens, is difficult to resist.
"But you're here with me."
He whispers so low I almost don't catch it. Instead, the words linger, smoke between us. I have no answer for him. None I'm willing to give or admit. I'm no stranger to shame. I certainly feel it now, as I stand in his bedchamber, with Killorn recovering miles away. Killorn, who wouldn't be here if not for me.
"It isn't your fault."
Tiberius pushes on. He knows me well enough to guess my thoughts. What happens to him isn't on your shoulders. He makes his own choices. And without you, what you did for him, his voice trails off. You know where he would have ended up. Conscripted. Doomed to a trench or a barracks. Probably dead in the final gasps of the Lakelander War. Another name on a list. Another red lost to silver greed. Another person forgotten. Because of people like you, I think. Forcing a deep breath. The bedroom smells like salt air, fresh from the open windows. I try to take some comfort in what he says, but I can't. It doesn't excuse anything I've done, or what Killorn has become because of me. Though I suppose we've all changed since last year. Since that day when his master died, and he stood in the dark beneath my house, trying not to mourn his life as it was snatched away. I swallow hard, remembering what I said. Leave everything to me. I wonder if we changed into who we were supposed to become, or if those people are gone forever. I guess only John would know, and the seer is long gone, far out of reach. Clearing my throat, I changed the subject with little tact. I hear there's a Lakelander fleet on the horizon. I put my back to him, turning to face the exterior door, the one leading back into his receiving chamber. I could walk out right now if I wanted. He wouldn't stop me. I'm just stopping myself with every single breath.
I hear that too, Tiberius replies.
Then his voice drops, deepening. It wavers in fear.
I remember darkness, emptiness, nothing.
Reluctantly, I look over my shoulder to watch him stand, shedding the last of his armor, avoiding my gaze. He's still tall, still broad, but lesser, without the weight of the battle-worn steel. Younger looking, too, just 20 years old. Tipping on the edge of manhood, parts of him still clinging to youth, holding on to something as it disappears, just like the rest of us.
I went into the water, and I couldn't get back up.
He kicks the pile of steel on the floor.
Couldn't swim, couldn't breathe, couldn't think.
I feel like I can't breathe either. Tiberius shudders as I watch, a tremor that starts in his fingers. His fear is terrifying. Then he forces himself to look back at me. With his feet planted and his hands firmly settled on his hips, he is rooted. The king won't move unless I do. He's going to make me surrender first. It's what any good soldier would do. Or he is simply letting me choose, letting me decide for both of us. He probably thinks it's the honorable thing to do.
I thought of you before the end, he says. I saw your face in the water.
And I see his corpse again, suspended before me, dappled by the shifting light of a churning sea, afloat at the mercy of a foreign tide. Neither of us moves.
I can't,
I bite out, looking anywhere but his face. He responds quickly with force.
Neither can I.
But I also can't stay away, keep doing this, denying ourselves in the face of always looming death. Tiberius hisses out a breath.
Neither can I.
When we take the step forward together, from opposite directions, both of us laugh. It almost breaks the spell. But we keep walking, equal in motion and intention, slow and methodic, measuring. He watches me, I watch him, as the space closes between us. I touch him first, putting my palm flat over his thudding heart. He inhales slowly, his chest rising beneath my fingers. A warm hand slips around my back, splaying wide over the base of my spine. I know he can feel my old scars through my shirt, the knobbled skin familiar to us both. I answer by curling my other hand at the nape of his neck, gently digging my nails into the lock of black hair. This doesn't change anything, I say, against his collarbone, a firm line against my cheek. I feel his answer in my ribcage. No. We aren't making different decisions. His arms tighten around me.
No.
So what is this, Cal? The name has an effect on us both. He shivers and I move closer, flattening against him. It feels like giving in, for both of us, though we have nothing left to surrender.
We're choosing not to choose.
That doesn't sound real.
Maybe it isn't.
But he's wrong. I can't think of anything more real than the feel of him. The heat, the smell, the taste. It's the only real thing in my world. This is the last time, I whisper before I cover his mouth with mine. Over the next few hours, I say that so many times, I lose count.
21. Maven. I hate the waves. They offend me. Every heave of blue against the hull of the boat makes my stomach toss, and it is entirely too difficult to remain still, silent, the image of reserved strength I need to be. Perhaps Iris or her mother is roiling the sea on purpose, in punishment for my risking Iris's life in Harbor Bay. Even though she survived and escaped easily enough. Survived, escaped, and lost the city to my perfect brother. I wouldn't put it past the Lakelander Queen. She's even more powerful than her daughter. Certainly she can control the rise and fall of the ocean around us. I spot her ships ahead, 6 of them. Small but formidable warships. Less of her armada than we expected. I snarl to myself, lip curling. Can no one simply do as they're told? Even with her daughter in the balance, leading the failed defense of the city, Queen Senra hasn't brought her full strength. A trickle of heat bursts through me, a tongue of angry fire down my spine. I restrain it quickly. The constant motion makes it more difficult to keep my grip on the rail of the deck. It drains my focus. And when I lose focus, my head becomes less quiet. Harbor Bay is gone. Another thing lost to Cal, the familiar voice whispers. Another failure, Maven. Mother's voice has grown fainter as time passes, but she never truly recedes. Sometimes I wonder if she planted a seed in me, leaving it to bloom only after her death. I don't know if whispers can even do that, but it's an easy explanation for the murmurs and the mutters that rattle around in my skull. Sometimes I'm glad for her voice, her guidance from beyond the grave. The advice is always small. Sometimes it's something she used to say before she died. Sometimes it could be just memories. But I wake up far too often from uneasy sleep, her words ringing in my ears. For her voice to simply be a product of my own mind. She's here with me still, whether I want her to be or not. I call it a comfort, even when she is anything but. All that matters is the throne, she whispers again, as she whispered over the years. Her voice is almost lost to the swell of the ocean. Part of me strains to hear, and part of me tries not to listen. And what you have given to get it. That is today's refrain. It repeats as my flagship sails toward the waiting armada, cutting through the waves as the sun sets low and red against the distant coast. Harbor Bay still trails smoke, teasing me on the horizon. At least her voice is gentle today. When I falter, when I slow down, it turns sharp, a fraying, splintering shriek, steel on steel, glass popping in the heat of flame. Sometimes it's so awful I check to make sure my eyes and ears aren't bleeding. They never do. Her words never exist beyond the cage of my head. I stare at the waves ahead, each one a white crest of foam, and think of the path laid out. Not before, but behind. How I came to stand on the prow of a ship, a crown low across my forehead, with the spray of salt water drying on my skin. What I gave to be here, the people I left behind, willingly or not, dead or abandoned or betrayed, the terrible things I've done and let be done in my name, how much will have been in vain if I fail. And now I race toward a Lakelander fleet, enemies turned allies through my own careful maneuvering. Like the rest of my country, I was taught to hate the Lakelands, to curse their greed. Perhaps more than anyone else, I learned to despise them. After all, my own father and his father spent their lives locked in a stalemate war on the northern border. They saw thousands wasted against the blue uniforms, drowned in the lakes, obliterated by minefield and missile. Of course, they knew what the war was truly for. I don't know if Cal, the poor, simple brute, ever connected such easily traced dots, but I certainly did. Our war with the Lakelands served a purpose. Reds outnumber us. Reds can overthrow us. But not if they die in greater numbers than we do. And not if they fear something else more than they fear the Silvers standing over them. Be it dying in war, or just the Lakelanders, anyone can be manipulated against their own interests if given the right circumstance. My ancestors knew that well enough, in their deepest hearts. To maintain power, they lied, they manipulated, they spilled blood. Just not their own. They sacrificed life, but not the lives closest to them. I can't say the same. Mother is never far from my thoughts, not just because of her voice running through my mind, but simply because I miss her. The ache is permanent, I think, a dull pain that dogs my every step, like a missing finger or a shortness of breath. Nothing has ever been the same since she died. I remember it, the sight of her brutalized corpse in that red girl's hands. The memory is a punch in the gut. It isn't the same with Father. I saw his corpse too, but felt nothing for it. Not anger, not sadness, just emptiness. If I ever loved him, I have no memory of it. And searching for one only gives me a headache. Of course, Mother removed it. To protect me, she said, from a man who did not love me as he loved her rival son, my older brother. The perfect boy in all things. That love for Cal is gone too. But sometimes I feel its ghost. Moments return at the oddest times, drawn out by a smell or a sound or a word spoken a certain way. Cal loved me, I know that, of course. He proved it many times over many years. Mother had to be more careful with him, but in the end it wasn't she who severed the last thread between us. It was Mare Barrow. My brilliant fool of a brother couldn't keep side on all that was his, in what little was mine. I remember the first time I watched the security footage of them together, dancing in her forgotten room tucked away in the summer palace. It was Cal's idea, their meetings, their dance lessons. Mother sat by my side, near enough if I needed her. I reacted as she trained me to, without feeling, without even blinking. He kissed her like he didn't know or didn't care what she meant to anyone but himself. "Because Cal is selfish," Mother croons in the memory and in my mind, her voice like silk and like a razor. The words are familiar, another old refrain. Cal sees only what he can win and what he can take. He thinks he owns the world. And one day, if you let him, he will. What will that leave for you, Maven Kalor? The scraps? The leftovers? Or nothing at all? My brother and I have something in common, at least. We both want the crown, and we're both willing to sacrifice anything to have it. At least I, in my worst moments, when the wretchedness threatens to overwhelm me, can blame such wanting on my mother. But who can he blame? And somehow everyone calls me the monster. I'm not surprised by it. Cal walks in a light I'll never find. Iris is always going on and on about her gods, and sometimes I believe they must be real. How else is my brother still living, still smiling, still a constant threat to me? He must be blessed by someone or something. My only consolation is knowing I'm right about him, and always will be. Right about Mare, too. I poisoned her enough, tainted her enough. She'll never tolerate another king, not for any amount of love. And Cal has discovered that firsthand. Another gift of mine across the miles between us. I only wish I'd figured out a way to keep that strange new blood, the one who bridged a connection between Mare and me. But the risk was too great, the reward too small. An obliterated base for the chance to speak with her again? It was a foolish trade, and even for her, I wouldn't make it. But I wish I could. She's out there across the waves, somewhere in the city along the distant crimson coast. Alive, obviously. Or else we would know it. Even though it's only been a few hours, the death of the Lightning Girl would not be a secret for long. The same goes for my brother. They survived. The thought makes my head pound. Harbor Bay was a logical choice for Cal. But the Red Tech slum was obviously Mare's own brainchild. She is so married to her cause, in all her red-blooded pride. I should have predicted she would go after Newtown. It's sad, really, to know that her cause relies on people like Cal, his sneering grandmother, and the Samos traitors. None of them will give her what she wants. It will only end in bloodshed, and probably her own death when all is done. If only I had kept her closer. A better guard, a tighter leash. Where would we be now? And where would I be if Mother could have removed her from me, as she removed Father and Cal? I can't say. I don't know. It hurts my head to wonder. I look down the deck at the soldiers manning the ship. She might have been beside me, if not for a few missteps. The wind in her hair. Her eyes shadowed and sunken, wasted by the manacles keeping her tethered to me. An ugly sight, but still beautiful. At the very least, she is still alive. Her heart still beats. Not like Thomas. I wince as his name crosses my thoughts. Mother couldn't remove him either. Not the agony of his loss, nor the memory of his love. That future is gone, killed, chased out of existence. A dead future, that horrible new blood seer used to call it. I think John was my tormentor more than I was his jailer. Clearly, he could have left whenever he wanted, and whatever he accomplished in my palace is still budding fruit. Again, I look out to the water, to the east this time, over a vast and endless ocean. The emptiness should calm me, but two early stars hang above the waves. The bright, cheerful lights offend me, too. Queen Senra's ship is easy to spot as we sail closer. The waves beside it are calm, almost still, a flat quelling of water. Her ship hardly rocks, even this far from land. The Lakelander ships aren't as sleek as ours. Our manufacturing capabilities are better than those in the Lakelands, thanks in very large part to the tech slums that Mare is intent on destroying. Even with her ships and my own, our guns are few, and anything we might use against the city will certainly meet resistance from Magnetrons and New Bloods, if not my foul brother himself. Only the Harbor Bay battleship, Iris's for now, has any kind of artillery that could be of use this far out. I glare at it, the steel craft anchored alongside Senra's ship. It casts a long, jagged shadow, planted firmly between the Lakelander Queen and the coast. My scheming queen is using it as a shield, a very expensive shield. I growl to myself as I board her ship, careful to keep my feet when I step from one deck to the next. My own sentinels flank me as we walk. Too close for comfort. I keep my hands at my sides, ungloved, fingers bare in threat.
This way, Your Majesty, a single Lakelander says, beckoning from an open door bolted with rivets and a wheel lock. The queens are waiting. Tell them the king waits on deck, I reply, turning aside to walk the edge of the ship. This isn't a pleasure cruise, and there aren't many places to stand, let alone congregate. But I'd rather stay on deck than go below, to be trapped behind steel with a pair of nymphs. My sentinels walk ahead of me, careful to keep in formation, as we climb a set of stairs to a landing overlooking the prow. It doesn't take the queens long to appear, moving in tandem. Senra wears a flowing uniform, dark blue with silver and gold chasing. A black sash divides her body from shoulder to hip, clasped in precious sapphire. In mourning, still. I don't think Mother wore her mourning clothes for more than a few days. Perhaps the Lakelander Queen cared for her husband. How strange. She watches me, storm-eyed, her skin a cold bronze washed gold by the setting sun. I feel as if I can read the battle on Iris. Her blue sleeves are charred to the elbow, the threads stained in two kinds of blood, and her long black hair is undone, still wet, brushed over one shoulder. A healer trails her, tentatively working on Iris's arms as she walks, smoothing away burns and cuts. Keeping her at an arm's length has been a wise decision. I want little to do with my wife, who would probably prefer to kill me. But like Red's, she can be controlled by fear and need. She has both in equal measure. So does Senra. It's why she dared to leave her borders. She knows I hold her daughter in the palm of my hand. I don't doubt she wants to extricate Iris from our marriage. But she needs this alliance as much as I do. Without me, she faces Cal and his band of traitors and criminals, a united front against her. I'm her shield, as she is mine. My queens, I say, bowing slightly to them both as they approach. Her daughter looks more like a soldier than a queen maid and princess born. The queen of the Lakelands dips into a shallow curtsy. Her sleeves brush the deck. Your Majesty, she replies. I turn my face to the horizon. Harbor Bay has fallen. For now, Senra says, her voice offensively calm. Oh, I sneer, raising an eyebrow. You think we can win it back? Tonight, perhaps? Again, she dips her head. In time. I finish for her. When the rest of your armada arrives. Queen Senra grits her teeth. Yes, of course, she reluctantly grinds out. But, I ask. The sea air feels cold on my bared teeth. We do have our own shores to guard, she says. At her side, Iris looks smug, glad to let her mother fight this battle. The lakes must remain defended, especially from Montfort. They can cross prairie and strike our western border easily, as can the kingdom of the Rift on our east. I have to laugh. Sneering, I wave a hand at the horizon, full of Samos traitors and Montfort usurpers, all beneath my brother's idiot command. Strike your border with what army? The one currently occupying my city? Senra flares her nostrils and a flush heats her face, dusting over her cliff-like cheekbones. Samos has the Norton Air Fleet, one of the biggest on the continent. Not to mention Montfort's own capabilities, whatever they are. Your brother has the advantage from the air, and he has the speed. Anywhere could be at risk of attack. She speaks slowly, as if I am a child who needs his hand held through war. It tingles my fingers. That cannot be ignored, Your Majesty. As if on wretched cue, a battalion of air jets races over the coast in formation. The distant scream of them reaches us slowly, a dull and stretching roar. I fold my arms over my chest, tucking away my hands lest they ignite. Bracken's air fleet should be enough to hold them off, I mutter, keeping my eyes on the jets as they move, circling the city. Protective maneuvers. Iris finally finds her voice.
The bulk of his fleet was cannibalized by the Montfort occupation. They can't match what we're up against.
She clearly delights in correcting me. I let her take this small comfort instead of losing my temper.
To look powerful is to be powerful.
Mother said that too many times to count.
Look calm, still, strong, assured of yourself and your victory.
Which is why we have to return to a place of strength, Senra says. We're no good out here on the waves, waiting to be picked off from the sky.
Even the nymphs of Signetline are not invincible.
Of course they aren't, you proud nit. Instead, I blink at her, trying to burn through her with my eyes. You suggest a retreat.
We've already retreated,
Iris snaps. The healer at her side steps back a little, cowed by her anger.
Harbor Bay is one city.
I clench a fist and a burst of heat ripples on the air. Harbor Bay is not the only piece of my country lost to my brother, I say quietly, slowly, low enough that they must strain to hear. The south is his, the Rift and Delphi. He took Corvium from me, and now he has Fort Patriot, too. My sneering queen doesn't quell against my checked fury.
Fort Patriot will be of little use to them for a long time, she says,
looking like a satisfied cat after a particularly big dinner. Oh, I reply. And why is that? She glances sidelong at her mother, sharing a look I cannot decipher.
When it became clear the city was lost, and that Tiberius would win the day, I flooded the fort as much as I could,
Iris explains, proud and still.
The seawall came down. Half of it is underwater, and the rest is cut off from land. I would have sunk the battleships if I could, but the escape took too much out of me. Still, the repairs will slow them down, and I've taken valuable resources from their effort.
And from me? Even if we win back the city now, the fort is destroyed. What a waste. Jets, the war port docks, arms and ammunition, simple infrastructure. I hold her gaze, letting a bit of my mask slip, letting her know that I realize what she's doing. Iris and her mother will incapacitate me little by little, cutting me off from my own resources. The nymph queens are cunning. They don't have to put me in the water to drown me. It's simply a question of how long that will take and how to balance their actions against my own. They're letting Cal and me waste ourselves on each other, hoping to face the wounded victor in later days. Iris stares back at me, her eyes tipping like a scale. She is cold and calculating, still water hiding a riptide.
So we return to Archeon, she replies. Gather the full mass of our strength, everyone that can be spared. Bring the full fury of this war to bear on their heads.
I lean back against the rail of the ship, exuding an appearance of calm detachment. Sighing, I glance at the waves as they stain red with sunset. We'll move tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Senra balks. We should go now.
Slowly I grin, careful to show my canines, the kind of smile that sets people off balance. I have a feeling my brother will be sending us a message soon.
What are you talking about? Senra murmurs.
I offer no explanation and look out to the east instead. On the darkening horizon, smudges stand out against the stark line of the sea. The islands will be neutral ground, I muse.
Neutral ground, Senra repeats, turning the words over in her mouth.
Iris says nothing, but her eyes narrow to slits. I drum my fingers against my chest, huffing out a low breath. What a joyous reunion this will be. I can only imagine it. A rainbow of scowling backstabbers and betrayers seated across from us, ready to preach and preen. Evangeline, with her claws and her put-upon arrogance. That Red General Farley, who will bleed for all she's done to my kingdom. Moping, methodic Julian, trailing my brother like a forgotten ghost. Our own grandmother, Annabelle, another person who was supposed to love me and never did. The Montfort leader, still a mystery and a danger. Of course, Mare will be there, a storm in her skin. And my brother, too. It's been a long time since I've looked into Cal's eyes. I wonder if they've changed. For I certainly have. Will we make terms? I very much doubt it. But I want to see them again, both of them. At least once more before this war is done, ended in whatever fate, their deaths or mine. Neither future frightens me. My only fear now is losing the throne, the crown, the reason for all this misery and torment. I won't destroy myself in vain. I won't let this all be for nothing.
22. Iris. When Maven returns to his own ship, I fear he might force me to go with him and deny me a few more hours with my mother. To my surprise, his petty rage and his political cunning do not extend so far. We are left alone on Mother's flagship once more, given over to our own devices. With room to talk at length and time to plan. Either he doesn't see us as a threat, or he doesn't care to fear us. I would venture the latter. He has more immediate enemies right now, and can spare a little thought for his own wife. The Swan is a warship, built for battle and speed. What pass for staterooms are spare and rigid, barely suited to Red servants. Still, Mother looks at home in them, equally at ease upon a bolted-down narrow bed as on a jeweled throne. She isn't a vain woman and carries none of the flawed materialistic pride most Silvers have. That was Father's domain. He preferred his finery, even on the battlefield. The thought sends a sharp stab of pain through me as I remember the last time I saw him alive. He was dashing in his armor, blue steel studded with sapphires, gray hair pulled back from his face. I suppose Salin Iral found some flaw and exploited it well. I pace to settle myself, moving back and forth before my mother, stopping occasionally to glare out the small porthole window. The sea outside has turned blood red, a bad omen. I feel a familiar itch and make a mental note to pray later on, in the Swan's small shrine. It might bring me a bit of peace. Be still. Conserve your strength, Mother says, her Lakelander melodic and fluid. She sits with her legs drawn up under herself, and her long-sleeved coat is tossed aside, making her seem smaller than usual. It has little effect on her bearing, and I feel the weight of her eyes as I walk. I am a queen too, and hesitate to follow her commands, if only to be contrarian. But she's right. I eventually concede and take a seat on the bench on the opposite wall, an uncomfortable thing with thin padding and rivets fixed to the metal floor. My fingers curl around the edge of it, gripping tight. It vibrates with the reverberations of the ship engines, low and humming. I fixate on the sensation, reclaiming a bit of my calm. In your communications, you said there was something you couldn't tell me, Mother says. Not until we were face to face. Steeling myself, I look up at her. Yes. Well? She spreads her hands wide. Here we are. My expression doesn't change, but I feel my heartbeat quicken with nerves. I have to get up again and cross to the window, look out on the crimson waters. Even though my mother's room is the safest place for me, it still feels dangerous to repeat what I know. Anyone could be listening, waiting to report back to Maven. I put my back to her and force out the words. We're operating on the assumption that Maven will win. She scoffs behind me. Win this war, you mean, but not the next. our war for this country. Yes, I reply. But I think we're on the losing side now. His brother's coalition, that Montfort army. Her voice is level, devoid of judgment. They frighten you. I spin around, scowling. Of course they frighten me. And the Scarlet Guard, too. Reds? Mother scoffs. She even rolls her eyes. I grit my teeth against a sigh of frustration. They're of little importance. That kind of thinking will be our ruin, Mother, I tell her as sternly as I can, one queen to another. Listen to me. But she dismisses me with a dancing wave, as if I'm still a child pulling at her skirts. I doubt that, she says. Silver's war, not Red's. They can't possibly hope to win against us. And yet they keep doing it, I answer flatly. I fought in Harbor Bay against the Samos heirs and their battalion, populated by Silvers and Newbloods mostly, but Reds too, skilled snipers, trained fighters, not to mention Norda's own Red soldiers who turned. One of Maven's great strengths lies in the loyalty of his people, but if it wanes, his Silvers will run and leave him empty. Mother just clucks her tongue. My teeth clench with the sound. The Reds keep winning because of the Silver Alliance, she says. It will quickly crumble when one or both of the Kalor brothers die. Wincing, I try another tactic. Instead of standing tall, I drop to my knees in front of my mother, taking her hands in mine. The pleading image of a child is sure to stir her. I know, Mare Barrow Mother, I tell her, hoping she hears me. Reds are made of stronger stuff than we realize. Yes, we make them think themselves inferior, insignificant, to keep them controlled. But we risk falling into our own trap if we forget to fear them, too. My words fall on deaf ears. She pulls one hand away, using it to smooth my hair away from my face. Mare Barrow isn't Red, Iris. Her blood certainly is, I think, keeping the retort to myself. Mother continues to run her fingers through my hair, combing out the strands. All will be well. All will be taken care of, she croons, as if to soothe a baby. We'll drown our enemies and return to our peace, safe at home. The glory of the Lakelands will wash forth to this very coast, across prairie, into those infernal mountains, to the borders of Ciron and Tyraxis, and Piedmont, too. Your sister will rule an empire with you at her side. I try to imagine what she dreams of, a map awash in blue, our dynasty secure in power. I think of Teora, tall against a new dawn, an empress's crown upon her head, resplendent in sapphire and diamond, the most powerful person from shore to shore, the world kneeling at her feet. I want that future for her. I want that sanctuary so much my heart aches. But will it ever come to pass? Annabelle Lirilan and Julian Jacobs have given me a message, I whisper, moving my head close to Mother's. If someone is listening at the door, they won't hear much. What? She hisses back, surprised. Her soothing hand drops. The other tightens its grip on me. They came to me in Archeon. The capital? How? Like I said, Mother, I murmur. I think Maven will lose this war, and lose quicker than we can imagine. They are a formidable alliance, stronger than our own, even with Piedmont on our side. Her eyes widen, and I finally see a flash of fear. As much as it terrifies me, I'm glad for it. We all need to be afraid if we want to stay alive. What did they want? She asks. They offered a deal. Mother's expression sours a little. Her lips twist. We don't have time for dramatics, Iris. Tell me what happened. They were waiting in my transport, I say. The Jacos singer is a talented one, and he bewitched my guards well. And the Lirilan queen is as dangerous as any. Her voice climbs an octave, panicked. Does anyone know? Does Maven? I put a hand to her face, forcing her to quiet. The words die on her lips. I'd be dead if he knew. Her skin is warm beneath my hand, soft and more wrinkled than ever before. These days have aged her. Annabelle and Julian did their work well. They need me alive, and they took no chances. Mother sighs in relief, her breath washing over my face. Solon Iral, I spit, almost unable to say the name of my father's killer. It cuts us both like a dagger. Mother recoils, disgust marring her features. They'll hand him over. Let us do with him what we wish. Her eyes go blank and dark. After a moment, she pushes away my hand gently. Iral is no one. A disgraced lord, stripped of his power. Alone in whatever wilderness he chooses. Electric anger screams down my spine. I feel myself flush, heat burning my cheeks. He killed father. Thank you for the clarification, Mother replies, her voice icy. Still, that blankness in her, a shield against the agony of my father's loss. I was not aware. I only meant he killed your father for another king, she says slowly. He is no one, Iris. Maybe. On shaky limbs, I force myself to my feet. I loom over her, and she has to look up to see my face. An odd position, an odd sensation, to have this power over my mother, even a power so small. I suck in another breath. Annabelle offered up Volo Samos as well. Below me, she blinks. Eyelids closing and opening, revealing a very different pair of eyes. They spark, alight. Now, that is something interesting, and perhaps impossible. I remember Annabelle as she leaned forward, bronze eyes gleaming in the light of afternoon. There was no lie in her, only hunger, only need. I don't think so. What do they want in return? Shaking, I tell her. Let her make this decision for me, because I cannot make it myself.
Tiberius, the seventh rightful king of Norta, Flame of the North, alongside his allies the Free Republic of Montfort, the Scarlet Guard, and the Independent Kingdom of the Rift, sends word from his temporary capital of Harbor Bay.
The sentinel reads from the neatly typed communication, his voice a bit muffled behind his jeweled mask. The floodlights of the ship deck illuminate him in blinding red and orange. Behind him, there is only darkness. No stars, no moon. The whole world could be empty.
Temporary, that's presumptuous, Mother sniffs, turning her face into the cool winds blowing off the black ocean.
We exchange glances, annoyed by the pageantry.
Flame of the North, what nonsense.
That's Cal,
Maven replies from his place among his guards. He called us to hear the message ourselves, summoning us to his ship.
He is a creature of want.
With a raised finger, he indicates for the stocky sentinel to continue. I recognize his voice and the eyes peering out from his mask. A vibrant blue, made electric by the sharp light overhead. Haven, I know, remembering the guard who accompanied me on my journey to Montfort.
I control the city behind you, he reads.
I think of the older brother, the warrior, wreathed in flame.
I control the southern borders from Delphi to our allies in the Rift. I control hundreds of miles of coastline, the entirety of the Beacon region, led by Governor Rombos and his house, has pledged loyalty to the true king. I have this kingdom in my fist, Maven, and you within my grasp.
Did we know about Rombos? I glance across the deck, looking to my twisted husband. Maven's deep scowl is confirmation enough. That betrayal is a surprise. Maven barely responds to the sentinel's words, only hissing out a breath.
Traitor.
I think I hear him mutter. Sentinel Haven forges on.
You have allies beyond your borders, Maven, but few within them. None who will not abandon you as my victories mount. The winds are blowing, the tide is changing. Norda cannot exist as she did beneath our ancestors, and I will not rest until I reclaim the birthright you stole from me at the cost of our father's life.
The guards rustle a little, but none of them speak. To them, this could be the wild accusation of a traitor, as Maven has painted his brother to be. Seduced by a red freak, manipulated into corruption and murder. But it's probably more likely a confirmation of what we all know to be true. Tiberius Kalor did not kill his father, not willingly, not the way Maven has said. Next to me, Mother fixes her eyes on my husband. They gleam, catching the harsh light. He doesn't react, still and smooth as glass. In his black uniform, his body seems to blend into the darkness, invisible but for his white face and long-fingered hands. Despite his brother's best attempts, Maven stays collected, reluctant to give over to a fiery temper.
"We are prepared to offer terms to all members of your alliance," Sentinel Haven rustles the page as he reads. "To Her Majesty Queen Senra of the Lakelands, and His Highness Prince Bracken of Piedmont. To you, Maven, usurper and murderer though you may be. No more blood need be spilled in this war of ours. Let us preserve what we can of the kingdom we were born to serve."
Such charming words. I wonder if it was written by committee. Annabelle, at least, had a controlling hand in the communication. Her fingerprints are all over the statement.
"We will meet upon the island of your choosing."
Sentinel Haven clears his throat, his eyes flicking to me first. Then to his king, a person living on borrowed time upon a stolen throne.
"At dawn."
We wait in silence, watching Maven as he weighs his options. He knew this was coming, and is hardly surprised. Still, he snaps. Slowly at first, then faster and faster. A clenching fist, the flame-maker bracelet spinning on a fine-boned wrist. It spits a spark that blooms, growing, a fireball burning white-hot and icy blue at its core. With a manic smile, Maven tosses it out onto the water. It trails, a near comet, reflecting with a hellish glow in the choppy water. Before he lets it hiss into the nothing among the waves.
"Dawn, then,"
he repeats. I can tell by the set of his shoulders that he has no intention of negotiating. I can only guess as to his motive, but I think it rests solely on one silver prince and one red lightning girl.
23. Cal. I shift. Uncomfortable as the minutes wear on. Midnight comes and goes. Only her eyes move, skimming the page with blurring speed. She might have it memorized by now. Mare wanted no part of the message to Maven, remaining in my rooms while the rest of us crafted it. I expected her to be gone when I came back. But she stayed. I still can't believe what happened. And I still can't believe she's sitting here, on my bed, in the middle of the night. After all that's passed between us, she stayed. I've given up focusing on the papers in front of me. Counts, mostly. Of soldiers, civilians, casualties, resources. Enough to make my head spin. Julian is better at deciphering all this, reducing everything to the most important details so I can see the larger picture. But I need the distraction, if only to keep me from the haunting little book in the desk drawer. I almost want to tell Julian to take it back. Keep his so-called gift until this war is won and I actually have the capacity to face what he wants me to face. Norda's situation requires my attention, not the book. And our situation is dire. Harbor Bay is ours, but it's a poor capital. The city is too old and vulnerable from all sides, and with Fort Patriot under repair, we'll have to build up new defenses for the time being. At least the city is with us, if only in name. Rombos surrendered, and the Reds of the Bay willingly follow their own leaders, the Red Watch, who are firmly allied to the Scarlet Guard. I tick off each group in my head, running down the endless list always racing through my brain. At this point, I think I even see it in my sleep. With a sigh, I try to clear my mind. I focus on her instead. Strange that she is both the anchor against the storm and the storm itself. Mare sits cross-legged on my bed, her head bent so her hair obscures half her face. The gray ends are creeping through the chocolate brown, dusting up against her collarbone. She keeps my nightrobe pulled tight around herself, the collar high enough to hide the brand on her skin. I shudder every time I see the mark burned into her and remember that my brother put it there. In the shifting candlelight, she looks like flame. Golden red, with black shadows dancing at her edges. I watch quietly from my desk, one bare foot planted on the floor, the other on the desktop. My calf twinges, still aching from the battle, and I flex my toes, trying to work out some of the pain. I wish I hadn't sent the healer away earlier, but it's too late in the evening to call anyone back. I'll just have to bear it until morning, along with the other small pains still cropping up whenever I move.
How long has it been?
She murmurs again, still not looking away from the page. I lean back in my chair a little and huff at the ornate ceiling. The electric chandelier above me is dark, unlit. It sparked out about an hour ago when Mare decided to furiously pace the room. Her moods have a trembling effect. 20 minutes since you last asked, I reply. I told you, Maven's taking his time with a response. He wants to make us sweat.
But it won't be much longer,
she says, unmoving.
He doesn't have that kind of restraint. Not with us. He won't be able to resist the chance of meeting us face to face.
Especially you, I growl.
And you,
she replies with equal fervor.
His mother poisoned him toward us both, made the obsession he carries now.
Annoyed, she sighs.
The meeting will be pointless. A waste.
I blink slowly. Her knowledge of my brother and how he thinks unsettles me. Mostly because I know what a high price she paid for it. And, if I'm being honest, because I know it's rooted in emotions I don't want to trace. But who am I to judge what she feels? I still love Maven too, or at least I love the person I thought my brother was. What a mess. Both of us. My knee cracks as I draw back my leg, an echoing snap. Wincing, I massage the joint, letting my hands warm to a soothing temperature. The heat sinks in, relaxing the muscles beneath. Mare finally looks up, smirking as she tosses her hair back.
You sound like a creaky door.
I hiss out a pained laugh. Feel like one.
See a healer in the morning.
Despite the playful twist of her lips, I hear her concern all the same. Her eyes narrow, looking darker in the dim light.
Or send for Sarah. She'll come now if you want. I don't think she or Julian will sleep until we get an answer.
I shake my head and heave myself out of the chair. I'll bother them tomorrow, I say, taking even steps toward the bed. Every foot closer seems to tighten my muscles with a different kind of ache. She tracks me like a cat as I ease down next to her, lying back on my elbows. An ocean breeze rolls in at the window, billowing the golden curtains with an invisible hand. We both shudder. Slowly, I take the letter from her hand, put it to the side without breaking our stare. I dread these quiet moments. And I think she does too. The silence, the empty waiting, makes it impossible to ignore exactly what we're doing Or not doing, rather. No change has been made on either side, in her heart or in mine. No choice reversed. But every passing second makes my decision more difficult as I'm reminded of what I'm going to lose when the time comes. What I lost for so many weeks. Not just her love, but her voice, her sharpness, the push and pull of a person who has no regard for my blood or my crown, someone who sees me and no one else in my place, someone who calls me Cal and not Tiberius. Mare puts a hand to my cheek, splaying her fingers behind my ear. She is more tentative than before, more clinical, like a healer examining a wound. I lean into the touch a little, chasing the cooling feel of her skin. "Are you going to tell me this is the last time?" I ask, looking up at her. Her expression melts a bit, as if wiped clean, but her eyes don't waver.
"Again?"
I nod against her hand.
"This is the last time,"
she says flatly. I feel a hum deep in my chest. My fire roars in response, begging to burn free. "Are you lying?"
"Again?"
Her lips twitch as I run a hand the length of her leg, from ankle to hip. The fingers on my face trace a gentle path as I bob my head, feeling my own blood heat. Mare's response is quiet, barely more than a gasp.
"I hope so."
She stops me before I can say anything else. Her kiss devours. No choice is made. Again. Mare is dressed, perched precariously in the open window, when someone knocks on the bedroom door, waking me. I half expect her to duck out and disappear into the night air, but instead she pulls back inside. Her face flushes, and she tosses me my robe. I get a face full of silk. "Staying put?" I ask, low enough so the person in the adjoining chamber won't hear. "You don't have to." She just glares at me.
"What's the point? Everyone will know soon enough."
"Know what exactly?" I want to ask, but I hold my tongue. Stretching, I stand from the bed and pull the robe tight, knotting it at my waist. She watches as I move, eyes trailing. "What?" I whisper, sporting a half grin. Instead, her lips press into a thin line.
"You had some scars removed."
I can only shrug. It's been weeks since I had a healer erase the older scars across my back and ribs, wiping away the raised edges of white, knotted flesh. Wounds unbecoming of a king. I'm a bit flattered she remembered enough to know. "Some things don't have to be held on to." Her eyes narrow.
"And some things do, Cal."
I can only nod in silent agreement, unwilling to follow her over the precipice of that particular conversation. It won't lead us anywhere productive. Mare settles against my desk, leaning a bit, squaring herself to the door. Her countenance changes, her eyes sharpening as the rest of her seems to harden into a different person. A bit of Marina, the silver she pretended to be. A bit of the Lightning Girl, all sparks and merciless fury. With herself in between, the girl I'm still figuring out. She ducks her chin, nodding at me. As I open the door, I can just hear her suck in a fortifying breath. "Julian," I say, moving aside to let my uncle into the room. He takes a step forward, already talking, a faded sweater tossed over his nightclothes. The page in his hand has very little writing on it. "We've received Maven's reply," he says. He falters only a little at the sight of Mare, doing his best not to let her break his momentum. He clears his throat a little and forces a casual smile. "Good evening, Mare."
"Good morning would be more appropriate, Julian,"
she says, dipping her head in greeting. unwilling to give anything more or anything less. But our appearance says enough. Her with still disheveled hair, and me in nothing but a robe. Julian reads us as easily as he does his books. At least he has the good sense not to comment or even smirk. I prod him farther into the room. What did Maven say?
As we suspected, he replies, recovering. He agreed. Dawn.
Already I curse my decision to meet so early. I'd much rather do this on a full night's rest. But it's best to get it over with as soon as possible.
Where?
Mare's voice is ragged. Julian looks between us.
They've chosen Province Island. Not exactly neutral, but most of the islanders have gone, fleeing the war.
I fold my arms across my chest and try to picture the island in question. It comes to me quickly. Province is the northernmost point of land in the Barn Islands, sprinkled in a hook off the coast. It's a little like Tuck, the Scarlet Guard base. Home to little more than disappearing dunes and seagrass. It's Rombo's territory, and small enough. If anything, this is in our favor. At the desk, Mare scoffs. She surveys Julian and me like children.
Unless House Rombos decides to betray you.
I'd be inclined to agree if his family didn't hang in the balance, or his own life. Lord Rombos won't risk either, I tell her. Province Island will do. She doesn't look convinced, but nods anyway. Her eyes pass to Julian, then to the single paper in his hand. The copy of Maven's response.
Did he have any other demands?
Julian shakes his head.
None.
May I see it?
She holds out a hand in gentle request, palm turned upward. Julian is happy to oblige. For a second, she hesitates, gripping the paper between her thumb and forefinger like something unclean. He used to write her letters, back when we were operating from the Notch, collecting new bloods. He used to leave them on the corpses of the ones he got to first. Each one begged her to return, promising to stop the bloodshed if she went back. Eventually, he got his wish. I would take the paper from her, protect her from the pain his words bring. But she doesn't need me to shield her. She's faced worse without me. Finally, she blinks, steeling herself to read Maven's response. Her frown only deepens as her eyes scan the words, over and over again. I glance at Julian. Has Nanabel been informed?
She has, he says. Does she have thoughts? When doesn't she?
I offer him a wry smile. True. Julian and my grandmother aren't exactly the closest of friends, but they're certainly allies, at least where I am concerned. Their shared history, my mother, is enough for them both. At the thought, I feel a sudden cold, and I can't help but look at my desk drawer. It's firmly shut, the book out of sight, but never far from my mind. Ocean Hill was my mother's favorite palace, and I see her everywhere, even though I have no memory of her face. Only what I've seen in pictures or paintings. I've asked for some of her portraits to be rehung, at least in the salon outside my bedroom. Her colors were gold, more vibrant than the yellows Julian wears now. Fitting a queen born of a high house, though she was far from the norm. She slept in this room. She breathed this air. She was alive here. Julian's voice snaps me out of the quicksand of my mother's memory.
Queen Annabel thinks you should send someone in your stead, he says.
A corner of my mouth tugs into a half-smile.
I'm sure she suggested herself.
His face mirrors mine. She did. I'll thank her for the suggestion and politely decline. If anyone is going to face him, it should be me. I'll present our terms.
Maven won't bargain.
Mare's fist closes, crumpling a bit of the communication. Her gaze feels like her kiss. Devouring.
He agreed to the meeting, Julian begins, but she cuts him off.
And that's all he'll agree to. This isn't to discuss terms. He isn't anywhere close to surrender.
I hold her livid stare, watching the storm in her eyes. I almost expect a peal of thunder overhead.
He just wants to see us. It's his way.
To my surprise, Julian takes a hurried step toward her. His face pales, draining of color.
We should still try, he pleads, exasperated. She just blinks at him.
And torture ourselves? Give him the satisfaction?
I respond before Julian can.
Of course we're going to meet with him.
My voice deepens, heavier than before. And of course he isn't going to bargain.
So why do this?
Mare spits. I'm reminded of one of Laurentia Viper's snakes.
Because, I mutter, trying not to growl, to keep some semblance of control and dignity. I want to see him too. I want to look into his eyes and know that my brother is gone forever.
Neither Julian nor Mare, two of the most talkative people I know, has any response to give. She looks at her feet, brows knitting together, while a red bloom rises in her cheeks. It could be shame or frustration, or both. Julian only goes paler, white as a sheet. He avoids my eyes. I have to know that whatever his mother did to him cannot be reversed. I need to be sure, I murmur, moving closer to Mare. If only to calm myself. I'm suddenly aware of the cloying heat in the room, rising with my own temper. Thank you, Julian, I add, trying to dismiss him as gently as I can. He takes the hint well.
Of course, he replies, bowing his head. Even though I've repeatedly asked him never to bow to me. Have you, he adds, stumbling over the question, have you read what I gave you?
The pain of another person lost flares in my chest. My eyes dart to the desk drawer again. Mare follows my line of sight, even though she doesn't know what we're talking about. I'll tell her later, at a better time.
Some, I manage to say.
Julian looks almost disappointed.
It isn't easy. No, it isn't, Julian. I'm done talking about this. And if you could, I mumble, gesturing feebly between myself and Mare to change the subject. You know.
Mare snickers slightly, but Julian is happy to comply.
I don't know what you're talking about, he says with an easy grin.
As he goes, stepping back out into the salon, I follow his retreating figure. When he passes the painting, propped up against a chair for now, he slows. But he doesn't stop. He only trails a hand along the frame, unable to spare a glance for his sister. They have a similar look, based on the portrait. The thin chestnut hair and inquisitive eyes. She was simple, an easy beauty. The kind most overlook. I don't have much of her in me, if anything at all. I wish I did. The door swings shut, removing her and my uncle from sight. Slowly, smooth fingers weave into mine, taking my hand.
He can't be fixed,
Mare breathes, resting her chin against my shoulder. Not quite on top of it, she can't reach, but now isn't the time to tease her. Instead, I lean down into her grasp, making it easier on us both.
I need to see for myself. If I'm going to give up on him, her grip tightens sharply.
There's no giving up against the impossible.
The impossible.
Part of me still refuses to believe that. My brother is not a lost cause. He can't be. I won't allow it. Davidson tried, I whisper, reluctant to say the words out loud, but I have to. I have to make them real. He searched. There are no new blood whispers. She takes a long, trailing breath.
And that's probably for the best, she says after a moment. In the grand scheme of the world.
It stings to know she's right. Methodic, she puts her hands on my shoulders, steering me away from the desk. Away from the memory sitting in a drawer.
You should sleep,
she says firmly, pushing at the bed.
Maven wears exhaustion better than you do.
I stifle a yawn, eager to follow her commands. With a sigh, I slip between the blankets. When my head hits the pillow, I almost drop asleep instantly. Will you stay? I mumble, watching her through slitted eyes. She crawls over to me in reply, kicking off her boots as she goes. She worms her way under the silk. I watch her, smirking, and she shrugs.
Everyone will know anyway.
Without thought, I take her hand, knitting our fingers at the hem of the blanket. Julian can keep a secret. Mare barks out a laugh.
Evangeline can't. Not with her agenda.
I have to chuckle, too, half-hearted in my exhaustion. Whoever thought she'd be the one pushing us at each other? Next to me, she shifts, trying to get comfortable. Eventually, she settles on curling up at my side, one leg kicked free.
Even though Maven can't change, other people can,
she mumbles against my chest. The vibrations of her voice make me shiver. It takes little concentration to douse the candles burning all over the room, plunging us both into a gentle blue darkness. I don't want to marry her.
That's never been my issue.
I know that, I whisper. It isn't in me to give her what she wants. Not when it means betraying my father, my birthright, and any chance I may have at making some kind of difference. She might not agree, but I can do more on a throne, with a crown, than I can without them. After the parley, I breathe, hesitant. Once Harbor Bay is secure, I think we hit Greytown next, full strength. We won't catch another tech slum off guard, not after Newtown. In the darkness, the brush of her lips on mine takes me off guard. I jump at the sensation. I feel her smile against my skin.
Thank you,
she whispers, shifting back into place. It's the right thing to do. But am I doing it for the wrong reason? For her? Does that even matter?
What did Julian give you?
She mumbles, half asleep. Mare is just as tired as I am, if not more. The day has been too long and too bloody. I blink in the darkness, staring at nothing. Her breathing slows and evens as she drifts away. She's asleep when I finally answer. A copy of my mother's diary.
24. Mare. It's still dark outside when I wake, roused by shuffling across the room. I tense on instinct, ready to fight. For a second, I'm puzzled by the sight of Cal in the same chamber as me. Then I remember the events of yesterday, his near death, and the way it broke us both, shattering whatever resolve we'd had before. He's already dressed, looking regal, in the soft light of a few candles. I watch for a second, seeing him without any kind of mask or shield. Despite his broad, tall form, he looks younger in his fine clothing. His jacket is a deep blood red, trimmed in black, with silver buttons at the cuffs. The pants match, tucked into oiled leather boots. He hasn't donned a cape or a crown yet, leaving both discarded on his desk. He moves slowly, fastening the buttons up his throat. Shadows ring his eyes. He looks more exhausted than he did last night, if that's possible. I wonder if he slept at all, or if he spent the night tortured by the prospect of seeing Maven again. When he realizes I'm awake, he straightens, shoulders squaring toward me. He fills the kingly mold quickly. The transformation is small but unmistakable. He puts up his guard, puts on a mask, even with me. I wish he wouldn't, but I understand why. I do it too.
We leave in an hour, he says, finishing with his buttons. I've had some clothes brought into the salon for you. Choose whatever you like, or...
He stumbles, as if he said something wrong.
Whatever you want from your own wardrobe.
I didn't exactly bring my wardrobe to a battle, and I don't think I can fit into one of your uniforms, I reply, chuckling a little. With a reluctant groan, I stretch out of the blankets and shudder at the touch of cold air. I sit up, intensely aware of the tangled braid over my shoulder. I'll find something. Should I look a certain way? A muscle feathers in his cheek.
However you wish, he says,
his voice oddly strained. Should I be distracting? I ask, gingerly trying to work the knots out of my hair. He looks at my fingers, not at me.
I think you'll be distracting no matter what you wear.
My chest tightens with warmth. Flattery will get you nowhere, Cal. But he isn't wrong. It's been months since I last saw Maven in the flesh, his form retreating through the surge of a panicked crowd. Iris ran with him, defending her new husband from the attack on their wedding in the capital. It was a rescue mission, not just for me, but for dozens of new bloods manipulated into his service. I could wear a potato sack, and Maven would still devour me with his eyes. Yawning, I pad across the room and into the bathroom for a quick, blistering hot shower. Part of me wishes Cal would join in, but he stays behind, and I scrub the last of my aches away alone. After, I enter the salon to find a rainbow in the semi-darkness. With a slight burst of concentration, I make the electric lights flicker to life overhead, illuminating the chamber full of various garments. I'm glad for the wide choice of clothing, but even more grateful for the emptiness of the salon. No maids to attend to my hair and face, no healers to work away the gnawing exhaustion or liven up my body. I'm given only what I need and exactly what I want. If only Cal could do that in all things. I try not to think beyond this morning. He still hasn't turned away from the crown, and I am still just as dedicated to my cause, if not more so. I can't still be in love with a king when everything I'm doing is to destroy his throne. Destroy all notions of kings and queens and the kingdoms at the mercy of their will. But the love just won't go away, and neither will the need. I wonder who laid out the variety of clothing, draping chairs and couches with a selection of gowns, suits, blouses, skirts, and pants, with no fewer than 6 different pairs of shoes on the floor beside them. Many of them are gold, either patterned in dusty yellow or trimmed with the colors of Cal's mother. She was a thin woman, judging by the narrow waistlines of her dresses, smaller than I would expect for the mother of the man in the room behind me. I avoid her clothing as best I can, and search for something that doesn't carry the weight of a dead woman. I settle for a flowing dress, belted at the waist, dyed a deep, rich navy blue. The colors of someone else's mother. It's velvet, and I'll certainly sweat out of it later on. But the neckline, a gentle swoop below my collarbone, puts my brand on full display. Let Maven see what he's done to me, and never forget what kind of monster he is. I feel stronger as I pull it on, as if the dress is some kind of armor. I can only imagine what kind of elegant monstrosity Evangeline will pull together for the meeting. Perhaps a gown of razor blades. I hope she does. Evangeline Samos excels in moments such as these, and I can't wait to unleash her on her former betrothed, unbridled by any kind of etiquette or scheme. When I finish, I comb out my drying hair, letting it fall loose about my shoulders. The gray ends gleam in the lamplight, sharp in contrast to the brown. I am a strange-looking person, I think as I examine myself in a mirror. A red girl in silver finery never ceases to surprise me. My skin glows golden with the low light, stubbornly alive and stubbornly red. I'm less haggard than I thought, my brown eyes luminous with both fear and determination. I draw some comfort from knowing that Cal's mother, though she was silver, wasn't fitted to this life either. It's written so clearly in the portrait of her, which lies against the far wall, nestled next to a pair of ornate chairs. I wonder where Cal will hang her, out of sight or always in reach. Corianne Jacobs had soft blue eyes, if the painting is a good likeness. Like a sky before dawn, the haze of blue upon a horizon, almost colorless, drained of a deeper shade. She looks more like Julian than like her son. Both of the same chestnut hair, hers curling artfully over one shoulder, well-dressed, with creamy pearls and gold chain. Their faces are similar, too. Drawn, older than their years. But while Julian's strain has always seemed pleasant, the accepted frustration of a scholar constantly working a puzzle, Corianne's looks bone-deep. She was a sad woman, I'm told, and it shows even in her portrait. Ilara killed her, Cal says from the doorway to his bedchamber. He adjusts the cape draped over one shoulder, clasped in silver and glinting chips of black gemstones. In his other hand, he holds a black crown, half hidden, like an afterthought. A sword hangs from the belt at his waist, tucked into a sheath jeweled in ruby and jet. It's for fashion, at best. No one would choose a sword to fight. She drove my mother deeper into her sorrows, whispered in her head until she had no other escape. I know that now. His lips curve downward, frowning, while his eyes go far away. In his sadness, I see a bit of his mother, the only resemblance I can draw between the two of them. I wish I could have known her, I say.
So do I.
We leave Cal's rooms together, walking the halls of Ocean Hill down to the grander, more public receiving chambers in equal step. Last night, I brushed off any worry of gossip, feeling brazen and bold. The discomfort catches up to me now. I wonder if we'll enter to a rash of murmurs, smirks from the silvers, judgment from the reds, and new bloods. Will Farley sneer at me for wavering? Will she turn her back entirely? I can't stand the thought. Cal senses my unease. His fingers brush the inside of my arm, careful to stay away from the sensitive points of my wrists.
We don't have to enter together, he murmurs as we descend a flight of stairs, growing closer and closer to the point of no return.
It doesn't matter now, I answer. Up ahead, his guards await. Members of House Larilan, cousins of his grandmother's blood. They stand unmasked, unlike sentinels, but just as dangerous and silent. Annabelle stands with them, hands clasped at her waist, belted with flaming jewels, rubies and yellow citrine. She proudly wears her rose-gold crown, the simple band fitted across her brow and smooth, gray hair. Her eyes land on me first.
Good morning, she says, drawing Cal into a quick embrace.
He accepts it quickly and dwarfs her.
Morning,
he replies.
Is everyone ready?
They should be, she says, waving a wrinkled hand.
But I assume we'll have to wait for the Rift Princess to don every piece of metal she can get her hands on. Remind me to make sure she hasn't stolen the doorknobs.
All nerves, Cal doesn't smile, but a corner of his mouth lifts.
I'm sure we can spare them, he says.
You look well, Miss Barrow, Annabelle adds,
her eyes flicking to mine. I don't feel it, I think to myself. As well as can be expected for the circumstance. I'm careful not to use any kind of title, but she doesn't seem to notice or care. Judging by the way her face changes, softening, I must have said the right thing. To my surprise, Annabelle has no enmity for me this morning. She draws a slow breath. "Ready or not," she mutters, spinning around. "Here we come, Maven." The receiving hall at the bottom of the grand stairs is vast, feeding into various ballrooms and the throne room of Ocean Hill, as well as the banquet hall and a smaller, less official version of the council chambers in Whitefire, built to suit a working court of silvers and house the moving government of Norta. Now, reds scatter among the rooms, busy as servants, but noticeably not servants. The green of Montfort uniforms contrasts harshly with the white marble, ocean blue trimmings, and many gold banners still hung from the walls and ceilings. I note red among them, the crimson of Cal's uniform, marking his position as the rightful king and conqueror of nearly half of Norta. As in Ascendant, before we addressed the gallery, Davidson wears his fine suit of dark green. Farley has her dress uniform as well, and is still just as uncomfortable in it. I'm glad I don't have to wear one. The gown is soft against my skin as I walk, my feet tight inside fine blue boots. Annabelle leaves us to stand next to Julian, while Farley watches us approach. She looks between me and Cal as we move closer to the center of the room. Her brow furrows, and I brace myself for a scowl, if not a snarl. Instead, she blinks, her expression thoughtful, almost accepting. "Kalor," she says, dipping her head to the king. He grins at her deliberate use of such an informal greeting. "General Farley," he replies, all propriety. "I'm glad you agreed to join us." She adjusts her stiff collar, forcing it to lie flat. "The Scarlet Guard is a valuable part of this coalition, and command should be represented when we negotiate for Maven's surrender." While Cal nods his head in gentle agreement, I sigh to myself. "I wouldn't be so sure of any deal," I warn her, voice low. I'm getting sick of repeating myself. Farley only scoffs. "Of course, nothing in this life is that easy, but a woman can dream, can't she?" I glance over her shoulder, at her various officers hanging back. None of their faces are familiar. "How's Kalorn?" I ask, frowning as shame claws up my spine. I wring my hands together, trying to hide their twitching. At my side, Cal flinches, one hand hanging free. I wish I could take it, but we both refrain from such a naked display of affection. She looks on me with pity. "Fully healed yesterday, but he's taking some time," she says. I try to picture him whole and healthy, not dancing at the brink of death as he was before I left. It doesn't work. "We've commandeered the barracks at the security center, and he's there with the rest of the wounded." "Good," I push out, unable to say anything more. Farley doesn't prod. Still, I feel the embarrassment of my choices as sharply as a knife wound. Kilorn almost died. Cal almost died. And you ran to Cal. Next to me, the true king looks away, his own face flushed with implication. Even though we both decided not to make choices, we know that choices were made all the same. "And Cameron?" I add, if only to stem the bleeding of such thoughts. Farley scratches her chin. "Organizing in Newtown. She's a valuable asset there, as is her father. The tech towns have their own underground networks, and word is going out to the rest. Maven's Silvers might be preparing for more attacks, but so are they." That swells me with pride, as well as trepidation. Certainly Maven will retaliate for what we did in Newtown and try to prevent the same from happening again. But if the red slums rise up, if the tech towns go dark, his war effort will all but grind to a halt. No more resources, no more fuel. we can effectively starve him into surrender. I notice we're waiting for Princess Evangeline again, Davidson says as he joins us. His own contingent of advisors hangs back, giving us space. I tip my head back and sigh. The only constant in this world. The Premier crosses his arms. If he's nervous, he certainly doesn't show it. A peacock needs time to groom its feathers, even steel ones. We lost a lot of magnetrons yesterday, Cal says, his voice low and stern, almost reprimanding. House Samos paid a high price for Harbor Bay. Farley stiffens, setting her jaw. I doubt they'll let us forget it, or fail to make us repay their sacrifice. That's a bridge to be crossed, Cal replies. Despite our history, I feel the strange need to defend Evangeline. If it has to be crossed, I say. But we can discuss that later, I add, nodding to the far archway, where Evangeline has just appeared with Ptolemus at her side. The pair of them wear matching clothes of pearly white and bright silver. He has a jacket, tightly fitted and buttoned up to his throat, pants and black boots similar to Cal's, and a gray sash fastened across his chest from shoulder to hip. The pattern on it is strange, but as he approaches, I realize that the black diamond shapes dotting the sash aren't a pattern at all, but knives fixed directly into the fabric. Weapons, should he need them. His sister is equally outfitted, the folds of her long gown slashed to show fine white leather leggings beneath. Should this meeting end in blood, she won't find herself restricted by a skirt. I wish I'd thought of that. Her hair is tightly braided back, the silver strands studded with starry glints of pearl metal, razor-edged, good for cutting flesh. Her arms are bare, no sleeves to impede her movement or catch on the jewelry on her hands. A ring winks on every finger. White stones in black and fine strands of chain wrap around each wrist. Garrets for strangling or slicing. Even her earrings look deadly, long and tapering to a wicked point. I find myself glad Evangeline took so much time. She's wearing an arsenal. Shall I have the clocks adjusted in your rooms, your highnesses? Annabel crows from where she stands next to Julian. Evangeline answers with a smile as sharp as her knives. Our clocks are exactly on time, Your Majesty. Her skirt billows around her legs as she passes the old queen, making for us. I shudder as she turns that smile on me. Good morning, Mare. You seem well rested, she says. Then she runs her eyes.